Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 438, recorded for air December 29th, 2013. The best of Twit. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and unfiltered. For 20% off on your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the offer code TWIT20. And by SumAll. Easily connect your data from Google, Twitter, YouTube, PayPal, Amazon, Facebook, and more to gain important insights instantly, all in one beautiful interface. Start using it for free today at SumAll.com. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Visit audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. Hi, everybody. A very happy December 29th in between Christmas and New Year's Day. Leo Laporte here. As always, on this last week of the year, we like to do a best of. And so what we've done is put together some of the best moments from Twit over the past 52 weeks, 12 months. These are many of them episodes that you picked on our best of page. And Chad Johnson, our producer, painstakingly stitched together, starting with something from not so long ago, episode 397. I guess it was a while ago now, come to think of it. The launch of the Galaxy S4. Let's take a look. We were both watching the Galaxy S4 launch out of New York City, which was Thursday. Neil, I was there.
I was there. Joanna was there. Saw her there.
I was unfortunately there. Very unfortunately, yeah. I was there.
So,
very I cannot tell you how terrible of an event it was.
Well, apparently Molly and I, who were watching from afar, both had the same reaction, which was not only whether it was sexist, but it was kind of tone deaf. It was like Samsung coming. What is that buzz?
Is somebody? Yeah, what is that? I don't know.
I'm turning off my phone.
Oh, yeah. Don't leave your phone on the desk. It's vibrating right into my ear.
You
know what they're doing? They're texting you saying, hey, you're on Twit.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I can see you right now. You're on Twit.
It is all notifications.
Wait a minute. This is St. Patrick's Day. You can't have a Twit on St. Patrick's Day without some green beer. So we're going to have now some magical harp. Hollywood is pouring me some harp.
Why can you? My boobs are pouring you some harp. Apparently.
Yes, well,
like, why are you doing that?
Are you still breastfeeding green? I see. That's good. That's good. Oh, you know, why are you doing it like that? Give me some foam. Give me a head. I never thought I'd ask Burke for head, but there you go.
Mayday. Mayday.
Okay.
Yeah. And now for discussion of women's issues.
That Gardner was hot.
I'm going to do my nails this whole time.
You just tell me when the show is over.
That was the funniest line.
I was going to get some beer, except that there's too many calories, so I'm going to go get a Zima real quick, and then I'll be right back.
Oh,
don't worry. S-Health can tell you.
That's S-Health. Right.
You're right.
Man, what an event.
That was the funniest part. I think the funniest line in it, where they're talking about how you can float your above the screen, not touch the screen. And why would you want to do that? Because my nails are drying.
My nails are wet, or I have lotion on my hands. I just can't. I can't do
it. I just ate something. I don't want to get my screen dirty.
I've had the lotion problem.
Sake, Joanna.
That does happen, but still.
So
I was actually telling Neil when I get my nails done, I have absolutely that's when I use my phone the most, actually, because you're like sitting there, you have nothing else to do. And it doesn't mess up my manicure. The magazine pages mess up my manicure.
So really, it wasn't so much that it was sexist as it was just wrong.
Yeah, totally wrong. This was factually wrong.
So I got to figure that something like half the market for Samsung phones is are women.
I mean, considering half the market for any phone, it should be women. The event was it was just Samsung wanted to put on a big show. And I think actually the most telling thing about it was at one point they said, we're going to launch this phone on you know, 2 billion carriers in something like 155 countries. And that's when I began to, thinking about it. It's like, oh, that's why this was so terrible. Because when you have to talk to that many people, you can only end up at the lowest common denominator. Right? And the very sad truth is that the lowest common denominator is just stereotypes of people. Everyone is like this, right? And that's, to me, it's, you have to be smarter than that. You have to think to yourself, well, we're talking to this huge audience, but the people who are covering it, the people who are going to be there and talk about it afterwards are not necessarily the huge audience. They're people sitting in New York and tech fans around the world who are a little bit more sophisticated than 155 countries on 300 carriers. And I think that's where they really messed up.
I'm not even sure. I see what you're saying, but they had to know who they were presenting to, because like you said, the audience for the actual show that they put on, I'd be very surprised if that was many more people than tech media and total tech enthusiasts.
Half a million people watched live on YouTube.
And oh, in the audience, really? It was unfortunately way more than just tech media or enthusiasts. I mean, it was tons of people. I mean, my biggest problem, as I told Neil, I was like, it was more the lack of wireless than the making fun of women or whatever else was going on in the presentation. But I mean, I ran into people there that I was like, why are you here? And like, oh, we got a ticket.
Yeah.
How did you get a ticket? How did people get tickets?
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Press was like, you know, all press usually get into Samsung events. We register, we go through the whole process. But I ran into a lot of like tech PR people that were just like, I just wanted to come see this. Event. You know,
well, they rented Radio City Music Hall, which must have cost them $1 million, right? Yeah. Some huge number.
It's more than that. Yeah.
Seats 3,500 people. Right. I don't know if there's 3,500 tech journalists who could go see this, right? I mean, they've got to fill it with somebody.
Well, they also flew in I'm pretty sure all the tech media from around the world. I mean, I was sitting next to a Russian journalist on my left and a bunch of, I don't know where they were from on my right. They were just, I just knew they were equally as mad about not having wireless.
Yeah, there's a guy behind me who was like, I flew in from Germany for this. I mean, Samsung opened it up. I mean, they were holding contests to give fans tickets.
That's great.
So yeah, I mean, all of that is great. And I think ultimately what happens is when a giant corporation decides to deliver marketing messages to people, they forget that people are actually people and not a collection of demographic information like women. You know, like if you just reduce women to like, here are the activities women do with a phone. Here are concerns we've heard about using a touchscreen phone from women in surveys.
Go ahead.
Well, no, it's just you immediately lose the fact that people are actually people, and you start thinking of them as how can we effectively talk to these like disconnected, disembodied concerns, and then you generate this thing. And you know, there's the only silver lining is like at least it wasn't as stupid as some of the other stuff they've done, right? At least that.
What have they done that was stupider than that? I mean, the sad thing to me is that they were to be totally clear. I don't think any of this, as I said on CNBC, is going to affect sales of the phone at all.
Like, really.
The chat room, right?
Yeah.
Phone's going to be absolutely fine.
Right.
Going to sell like gangbusters. Going to do great.
If anything, they did a disservice to the phone by not just focusing on it.
They should have. Yeah. I mean, it was, you could barely tell that they were introducing a new phone phone that is a really great successor to a really popular phone. And then the saddest thing of all is that I think they were actually trying to sell the phone to women. And that's why they had so many examples of contexts in which women or at least one-dimensional cartoon character ladies might want to use it.
Right. So I think that's the thing. So they got, this is what I'm saying. This is where they improved. They actually had the product involved much more so. Like, you know, in 2011 at CES, they had a whole presentation, and the point of that presentation was, I'm going to get this order wrong. They were moving from digital humanism to human digitalism. Not even kidding. Like that, I spent an
that
hour
was
and a
truth.
Half blogging this. They had the kid from Billy Elliot dancing around and saying insane crap. And I don't know why that happened. Like, I still,
it was amazing though.
It was amazing, and I had a lot of fun.
I can't think of another tech press conference where they had tap dancing. I think that's
I can, and they're all Samsung events.
Somebody in the chat room said nobody does weird like Samsung weird.
It was I mean, like stepping away from the part where it sort of did gradually just get more and more offensive. It was surreal. Like, it was beyond bizarre. I mean, I'm watching this thinking, well, at some point they're going to stop doing this, right? And then start to have like a presentation. And then every time I thought that, it just got weirder. And then there would be tap dancing. And then there would be like a, I mean, it just, I kind of don't understand, especially considering the money involved. Plus, why didn't you get a bigger star? Like, why did you get that orange guy from Smash that no one's ever heard of?
I have no
like,
idea who he was.
No, I had to Google it.
Someone was like, oh, Will Chase. I was like, I have no idea who
you know
that
why? Because Neil Patrick Harris could said no.
No, so it was all Broadway.
Say no
let me ask Joanna, because Joanna and Eli were there. And one of the things I thought, and maybe you too, Molly, is that those of us watching at home, we're watching on a screen that this is a big, big, big theater with 3,500 people. It's a big show. It might be playing differently to the people in the live audience. Was that the case, you think, Joanna?
I was trying to find wireless for 50 minutes.
That's all you cared about.
So I have really no clue what happened. All I know is I kept picking up my head and I was like, what the hell is going on? And why is there no wireless?
Stay away from the brown acid, Joanna.
I mean, let me just give you an idea of how there was no wireless. I had an AT&T phone, no service in there. LTE, Verizon, not working. Apparently 3G Verizon was working, and that's what saved Neil I and the Verge bunch. And apps, there was a press wireless, but that didn't work.
Were you trying to do a live blog, Joanna? Is that why you
were? Yeah, we were trying to live blog for ABC News and Yahoo. And I was just, sweating it out. But yes, I did keep picking up my head, and I was like, what is going on in here? And I mean, the no one in the audience was really reacting. Like, people were clapping because they felt like they had to, I think.
Well, that was another production error that we at home noticed, which is they didn't mic the audience. So even if the audience was clapping, it always sounded like this.
Yeah.
Plus, hasn't everyone learned at this point that don't clap on stage when you're mic'd because you will always sound like the only person clapping in the room? Like, it was just so...
Neil Patrick Harris would have known that. I got to point out. He would have known
you
that.
You would have known that.
There was big applause, I think, when they announced 13 megapixel camera. There was big applause for that. And then it just kind of went in waves. I think people were sort of like, are we supposed to clap now at the end of the scene?
There's one moment of huge applause when they announced the phone would have LTE. I still don't know why that happened. Like,
well, it was
maybe
LTE.
Invited a bunch of Qualcomm engineers, and they're like happy, they're drunk.
No,
they're
It was LTE worldwide. Yeah. We've had LTE in the U.S., but internationally, often not. And they said LTE in all 155 countries. That's an applause line, if it's true.
Yeah, but people thought the LTE would work in the audience.
Yeah, it was Verizon 3G.
Joanna's rage about this is like the best thing I've ever heard.
I mean, really, I'm still so...
Did I mention the wireless?
Okay, which was worse, the Qualcomm CES keynote or the Samsung Radio City Music Hall debacle? Because the Qualcomm was pretty bad too.
I got to go Samsung because there's bizarre and then there's bizarre and offensive.
Here might be the source
I'll
of the
kangaroo for sure.
Yeah,
or whatever they had on there, a donkey. I don't know.
Yeah, here's the thing about chip companies doing keynotes. They have no idea what they're selling or how to sell it, right? They're like, our chips are fast and you can do stuff with them. And because they're faster, here's some awesome
stuff
you can do.
Right.
And here's some people you can relate to. So the chip Intel keynotes are always crazy too. They had Aziz Ansari 1 year. I remember just like pretending to be a time traveler. And I remember, being like, this isn't affecting me. I don't know why I should. There's literally this audience is just watching this happen and wondering why you spent this money instead of like pushing chips forward. Samsung, on the other hand, I think they actually with the Galaxy S4, they have a similar problem is they have a phone with all of these features and all of these gimmicky, crazy features. Like, I don't think people want them. I told when I was going on CNN the next morning to talk about the phone, I told the person who is like the CNN makeup lady, I was like, oh, there's a new phone. It watches your eyes when you're reading a web page and scrolls for you. And she's like, I don't want that. She was like, that's freaky. And she started telling her friends, like, the new phone watches you. And they don't know how to sell it yet. And I think they concocted
trying to wave
all
off
of
Neil
these.
I. It's not working.
Yeah.
Do you think, Joanna, that it's a gimmicky?
I waved him off.
You think it's a gimmicky phone?
I mean, the idea that I think
how
they wanted to focus on the gimmicky features, which is the wave and the scrolling and that kind of thing. I think there are some really useful and practical features. They didn't seem to really want to like focus on those. But I do think, this idea of wanting to tilt and wave your phone is they're just trying to come up with ways to say, look at how we've been innovative in this space.
We actually
we've been saying for a while at CNET that Samsung has a little bit of feature-itis, right. Or maybe a yes. lot of feature-itis, and that they really do think that the way to, you know, our hearts is to just sort of keep cramming things into the phone as opposed to having a killer feature. And I almost feel like the saddest thing about this presentation was that that they could have, I think, had the self-esteem in a way to say, this is a great phone. The Galaxy S3 was a great phone. It was the first like phone all on its own to outsell the iPhone. And this phone is just as great and then some, and worldwide LTE and things like a few features like that yep. that are really important to people, like a really good camera, great battery life, and fast yep. data. That's all you got to say.
I actually,
drop the
yeah.
mic, give me the phone with a, by the way, a release date and a price.
But the problem
which
with...
we didn't pay.
Well, you know what? We could talk about Bitcoin because there's still a little energy in the room because we were talking before the show about it. I read a book.
You're a big fan of Bitcoin.
I'm not. I just think it's very interesting.
Why?
Well, of course, the first place that we got interested in was just merely the cryptographic mathematical background of it, which is kind of interesting. For those who don't know, Bitcoin is a non-governmental currency that is generated by solving very hard numeric problems. You assign a computer to do it. In the early days, it was easy. It gets harder and harder. And there's a limited number of Bitcoins, I believe 21 million, which they expect will be fully in circulation by 2140. It's going to take a while.
How do they know there's that many, A, and B, if they know there's that many?
It's artificially set at that many.
Okay, then how do they...
And that's to make it deflation, not be inflationary, right? So, well, I agree. There's a point to that. It's maybe a deflationary...
Now, how do they know you have a legitimate Bitcoin?
Oh, there's a very good system for storing Bitcoins. There's no physical entity, of course. There's no coin in Bitcoin.
No, it's a number.
It's a number
that you mine,
and you mine, and you have a wallet.
But there's no mining involved. There's no hose.
No,
or
the mining
shovels
is solving a tough
no
mathematical
grinding.
Problem. What's interesting is
it the
that,
same mathematical problem every time?
No, it's a variety.
Then why
of,
would it be different? And why would that make a coin?
Because it's an invention.
Couldn't this that better use of this work and effort be put someplace else?
Well, like that's maybe an interesting point because somebody just estimated about $150,000 a year in energy cost to generating to the Bitcoin because Bitcoin miners.
One Bitcoin. Yeah.
No, all of the current amount of Bitcoin being generated every year.
So much.
Because in order to generate Bitcoins, it gets harder and harder. It's designed to get harder and harder. It's an interesting story. It's designed by a guy who is anonymous, maybe a group we don't know.
Does that make you suspicious?
Well, no, because you don't really want to become well-known as a guy developing an
extra... You don't think it's Max Kaiser?
Extra-governmental...
He's the guy who's got... He's got an exchange,
$150,000 a day.
And power consumption.
A day.
Oh, so it's for the greenies.
So yeah, I'm trying to find the... the value itself is just set by the market and whatever.
That's right. And there are a number of exchanges, the best known as Mt. Gox.
But the problem is it's an asset, and like any asset, it's going to suffer.
It's not a physical asset, however.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, mentally, when people approach it, I mean, real estate, it might be a physical asset, but when people deal with it, it's through dollar transactions, typically through your bank, and all you see is a bunch of numbers.
So would you rather have a Bitcoin and just some...
I can't sleep on a Bitcoin, and I can't eat a Bitcoin, and I can't fashion a weapon out of a Bitcoin.
The thing that I find interesting about Bitcoin is that it's really saying... something a little bit about currency in general, which is it is, you know, our currency, the greenback dollar, which is probably the most
pretty much
trusted currency in the world.
Well, it's the only reserve currency in the world
at the moment.
Is what they call a fiat currency. Its value exists purely because of the faith of the users, the faith in the U.S. government, of course.
That was I don't see that any different than gold. The value of gold
very similar because there's some physical value to gold.
Except there's a minimum,
but it's not much. It's certainly not.
But you can't just print gold,
right?
But it's still that same kind of thing.
Right.
It's imaginary.
But once the dollar was eliminated from gold and silver backing in the days of Nixon, then it really was just a piece of paper, right?
Well, actually, let's start with Roosevelt, who confiscated all the gold.
Right. So the thing that I find interesting is that there can be an extra governmental currency. And the notion of Bitcoin is that it protects privacy, just as cash protects privacy.
Yeah, but apparently every Bitcoin transaction is so carefully traced that it doesn't protect privacy at all.
Well, the only identity you know is you have a numeric identity. You don't have a real identity.
But you do have an identity that can be tracked back somehow. Somebody wanted, if the NSA wanted to find out who numbers 6666689910.
That's interesting. I don't know.
They could do that, and then you say, well, that guy's been buying a lot of drugs.
Well,
how does this protect
that's
anything?
Actually the main use right now of Bitcoin is the imaginary website Silk Road where people are buying drugs.
The imaginary site.
Well, you can't go to silkroad.com. Yeah. You have to kind of.
You have to know the secret handshake the password.
That's what I was going to ask. Like I'm a little ignorant on this subject. Like, what is it mainly used for? But you kind of answered it.
Well, drugs. But it's not designed to be used in any way different from money. Though I think what it is it's kind of an interesting philosophical.
It's a great way to basically launder
what is
money.
But what is money really? Right? Money is imaginary. Money is an agreed.
It's a social
hallucination.
Construct.
It's a social construct.
It's essentially.
And it doesn't have to be backed by a government. In fact, it was only recently, in the last 100 or so years, that government had anything to do with it.
Gold isn't backed by a government, and people were trading those. You know, go to any kind of
your people were trading jade, as you
jade,
said.
Jade,
blue feathers,
anything, yap stones, yeah, giant oversized. Well, you know, impractical means of trade. But, I mean, people have all agreed, at least up to a point, that, you know, yeah.
Well, I think it's also interesting that Bitcoin arouses such energy in people like John.
Oh, yeah.
I would think you'd be in favor of it because it's a currency that is private and non-governmental.
It's not private, I just mentioned. Non-governmental doesn't bother me. I mean, I could go trade, you know, euros if I didn't want to be hounded by the U.S. government. It's beside
you'd be hounded
the point.
By the EU.
Yeah, worse. I don't like it because it's suspect. It's got this unknown origin. It's trading at all kinds of different weird prices. You got Max Kaiser coming out saying it's going to be worth $100,000 a coin, maybe a million.
You know, there's a great story, which I'm sure is well floated among Bitcoin users, of the guy who a couple of years ago bought a pizza with Bitcoin, which at the time was worth a few bucks, but now would be about $1.6 million, a very expensive pizza.
Yeah, to say the least.
Because there's a lot of speculation in Bitcoin. Bitcoin's been very volatile. It went up a lot. It was just at a record high and almost immediately plummeted because there was a big sell-off on Mt. Gox. There's the plummet right there on the graph.
Actually, there's a conspiracy behind that, or a conspiracy theory behind that, that people are trying to drive up, or a group of people are trying to drive up the price of Bitcoin, and they sell, causing people the value of the Bitcoin to
and
drop.
Then they buy some
and
more.
And then they buy some more. So they basically
it's speculation. Yeah. It's absolutely, I would say, vulnerable to that kind of speculation, especially as people like us and lots of people in the geek community and lots of.
Well, this is one of the things that bothers me. Is I'll bring up this distrust, let's say, of Bitcoin. And I'll get a whole bunch of stuff, you know, flack from, oh, you're a technologist. I don't understand how you don't subscribe to this. You're an idiot. You obviously don't understand the mechanism. And they go on and on. And this whole thing just kind of reeks of just some sour weirdness that I really don't trust this
thing
at all.
Well, that's why you don't trust it, because you don't fully understand the mechanism and you're not going to put your money into something some people do.
I would submit it's even worse than that. I think that people don't really want to think about the fact that there's nothing at all supporting the value of currency, that it is merely a consensual hallucination.
Well,
we don't really want to delve into the fact that paper money or even U.S. coins have no real value.
It's real.
It's what we say it is. The fact that the government 2 years ago printed billions of new dollars out of nowhere, it's unsettling to people. It works, and in fact, that may be one of the flaws of Bitcoin, is that you can't make new Bitcoin.
Well,
you can only make, by the end of the game, 21 million. If people hoard it, it's very deflationary because you can't, it's not.
I mean, that was one of the issues with the gold standards. You don't,
right.
You can't, hoard it. You cannot get enough gold to actually cover everything.
Right.
Unless you decide to make,
you could use the same model that the Bitcoins have, and you just keep subdividing. There's a limited number amount of gold in the world, although they do find some every once in a while. Which is like printing money the way I see it. But anyway, mainly because in 1949 during the gold rush, there was something like $30 trillion of new gold and silver injected into the economy by today's numbers. Anyway, so you could do what Bitcoin does with gold if you wanted to, but, you know, people shave the coins. And
it's true. Bitcoin has an infinite, can be infinitely divided.
Yeah.
Which in a way kind of.
People give me fractional Bitcoins. We accept Bitcoin donations, not because it's just because it's fun, and people want us to do that. And I said, "Fine." We've received about 1.5 bitcoins over the last
Ford
few weeks.
Does Ford pay you in bitcoins?
No, you better not. We want American dollar.
There it is. There it is.
Have you seen that really stupid meme? What is it? The Harlem Shake? Would somebody explain that to me?
Well, explain it to us. What you're talking about?
This week on Twit, old men discuss old money.
Old men talk about old ideas. Money. Guys don't know anything.
money.
It's of gray
the past.
Hair and greenbacks and memes. This so, week on Twit.
So the idea is this is based on what? This is a song by. It's a dance that can't. Oh, why am I getting an ad for Smoosh? What is this?
I don't know, but I'm Smosh. Not going to try it out.
Smosh. I don't want it. How do I close it? It's a takeover ad.
I mean, the latest thing is to get that little, little X at the bottom of the box.
I'm going to use new Smosh.
And you're gone.
Now I don't
Sucker.
Know. What, why did I do that? Okay, now I'm gone. I'm gone.
What happened
so,
to the thing?
Chad's a young person.
Chad, can you help us out with this thing?
Wow.
How does this
it doesn't seem
work?
To work.
So
the thing's broken again.
On the internet, you Google Harlem Shake, and then...
on the internet?
Now, yeah,
used Bing.
Exactly.
What's that?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So Harlem Shake is this... It's literally 8 days old. The first Harlem Shake video, which is this weird one right here...
Okay. ...was up... So it's this song.
You have to be in it.
Yeah, it was uploaded on February 2nd there.
Yeah, they're Power Rangers.
Yeah.
So they're doing a dance that was big in Harlem 20 years ago called the Harlem Shake. To a
We know that for a fact.
To a song that was created by, this guy named Bauer.
It looks rather suggestive.
Yeah, there's always an edge of...
I think these guys have got issues.
I don't get it.
So that was the first one.
Yeah.
And then...
So it always starts out in a normal environment. There's like an office one, right, at the Makerspace, where it's a normal environment... But there's one guy doing this stupid dance. And right. Then, for some reason, it's completely unknown. Everybody's dancing. And then it's over, like, at 15 seconds. It's the world's shortest.
Thank goodness.
Well, thank goodness for that, yeah.
I wish it were over now.
We salute you.
Yeah. Do you have the Office one?
Yeah, so, well, here, let me find the Office one.
Really, the Norwegian Army version is the best.
Here's the Office one. This one's pretty good.
This is like a Makerspace. So one guy's dancing.
In a motorcycle helmet, of course, because this is dangerous. Don't try this without protection.
And then the drop happens in the song, right? And then they're all dancing. It baffles me
punching
why there's what,
stuffed
they're, what,
giraffe.
It, what is interesting
having
about this at all.
Seizure with an iPad.
Yeah.
Okay, just shoot me.
Nerds.
Yeah, no, that's pretty bad.
Nerds. Come on,
it's
we
beyond
can do better.
Nerds. We got somebody behind us here doing the same thing, hoping to get attention.
That's. I think he's. It's that. That's our intern. That's Eli. He's a,
Eli.
He doesn't know any better. He's a high school student. He thinks it's a cool idea.
Yeah, he does.
I'll never get it. So,
well edited. A genius has edited that thing.
It's a proud moment for me when we had our very own Harlem Shake and I broke the table. By the way, that table is better than ever, I'm told. Not that anybody wants me to dance on. I think I've been told not to dance on the table anymore. All right, we'll be back with more of the best of This Week in Tech, including... our farewell to Aaron Schwartz and the announcement that Yahoo was going to buy a Tumblr for $1.1 billion. Our show today brought to you by ProXPN. I know a lot of you are concerned about privacy online, all of you. I know a lot of you are worried about things like the six strikes rules that the American Internet Service providers have adopted. Perhaps some of you worried about... geographic restrictions that'll keep you from watching the shows you want whenever you want. A good solution for this is something called an OpenVPN. Now, of course, you can run your own OpenVPN server, and some hardcore geeks I know do that, but it's a lot of trouble and it's easy to get it wrong. So most of us use hosted OpenVPN. My favorite, my choice, proxpn.com. That's X, not V. ProXPN.com. If you go to proxpn.com/twit, you can learn all about it. One of the things that's unique about ProXPN is that they have servers all over the world. So you understand that a OpenVPN encrypts the data from your machine to the OpenVPN server, and at that point it goes on to the public internet. The point of that is, you know, if you're at an open access spot at a Wi-Fi, you know, open access spot at a coffee shop, people can't see what you're doing. Everything you do is in an encrypted tunnel. It's you know, completely private. If you are worried about your internet service provider at home, same thing. They cannot see what you're doing. It's a completely blank slate to them. But at some point, all traffic has to merge onto the public internet so you can interact with the sites you want to. The one of the advantages that a ProXPN has is that they are not a U.S.-based OpenVPN provider. They have U.S. servers, Dallas, Seattle, Los Angeles, and New York, but they're based globally. They're in Singapore. They're in Amsterdam. They have London servers as well. So you can emerge into the public internet pretty much anywhere you want. That is very nice in eliminating geographic restrictions. It also means that they are not under the oversight or the, we might put it a little differently, the spying of the NSA. You've got what you really deserve, anonymous use of the internet without oversight, without snooping. Very easy to use. It works via OpenVPN. Some platforms, mobile platforms chiefly, don't support OpenVPN. They can use PPTP. But in almost every case, you can use OpenVPN, including on Android and iOS. They've really got great mobile apps for both Android and iOS. The Android app just came out that allow you to use OpenVPN, ProXPN, directly on those mobile platforms. That's really nice because, frankly, when you're on a mobile device, you are often in a public situation, and privacy really does become important. They do have a free version if you want to try it out, but I think you're going to want to use the paid version. It's very affordable. Normally, $10 a month, about $75 if you buy a year's worth. Lots more features with the premium version, but here's the special deal. If you use our offer code TWIT20, you're going to get 20% off that premium account, not just for the first month or the first year, but forever. So we're talking less than $5 a month when you get a yearly plan. That is a very good deal. And, of course, you can cancel any time within the first 7 days for a total refund. This is a very good way to do it. I want you to visit proxpn.com/twit. You can pay for your account if you decide to buy with Visa, PayPal, or Bitcoin, which I love for real anonymity. This is a great service. proxpn.com/twit. And don't forget, when you buy, use the offer code TWIT20 and you'll get 20% off, even if you pay in Bitcoin. 20% off. proxpn.com/twit. Offer code TWIT20. Now it's time to return to our best of episode. It was a tough, I think, a tough week for us when news came out. This is really, it was at the beginning of the year, that internet activist, one of the creators of RSS, had passed away due to, it seemed, undue government pressure in their prosecution of him as a hacker. And perhaps not the happiest moment on Twit, but I think we owed Aaron a goodbye, and this is what we did. Before we get back to CES, I think we should mention Aaron Swartz. What an interesting fella. Teen prodigy. If you read Cory Doctorow on Boing Boing, had a very touching, heartfelt eulogy for Aaron. Larry Lessig, who knew Aaron, had a very touching eulogy. Everybody seemed to know this kid, starting with around the age of 14, when he started showing up at computer conferences and trade shows. He was right about that age when he helped write the specification for RSS, which we use every day. That's how we do podcasts. He wrote some of the early code for Reddit and sold the code to Reddit. And he's sometimes called a founder. I don't think that's quite accurate, but he certainly wrote much of the code that Reddit's running. And he became a political activist in a very interesting way. Larry Lessig wrote, "He was brilliant and funny, a kid genius, a soul, a conscience, the source of a question I've asked myself a million times. What would Aaron think?" This is Larry Lessig, the Harvard constitutional law professor. Unfortunately, Aaron committed suicide, killed himself on Friday at the age of 26. And Larry Lessig and many others, including the family, blame the U.S. government. Larry says, "That person has gone today driven to the edge by what a decent society would only call bullying. I get wrong, but I also get proportionality. And if you don't get both, you don't deserve to have the power of the United States government behind you." Here's what happened. Aaron believed, like all hackers, that information wants to be free. There's a video of Aaron speaking. He started freeing information early on. It's interesting. He liberated the U.S. Legal code. So there's a system called PACER that gives you, in the United States, gives us access to case law, paid access to case law. Now, case law is public domain. Case law is what all the courts have ruled about stuff. It's what you would use if you were defending yourself, what the precedents, what the legal precedents are. You know, every lawyer has a law library, but then they also go online to PACER. And for a fee, they download these judgments. But those judgments belong to all of us. They're public domain. They're the U.S. courts. So activists built something called Recap and encouraged its users to take their case law downloads after they did it and post them on Recap, perfectly legal, because it's our stuff. And Recap was free and open, and anybody can use it. Well, Aaron took some of the money he made from the sale of Reddit and bought 20% of the PACER content and posted it on Recap. That's a guy who believes information should be free. He got in trouble with the feds. The FBI investigated him. Cory Doctorow says it looked like he'd be on the pointy end of some bad legal stuff, but he escaped it all and emerged triumphant because, in fact, he didn't break any laws. There wasn't a thing to do, but he did raise the ire of the United States federal law enforcement.
He annoyed a lot of people doing that.
He annoyed people. He founded a group called Demand Progress, which was one of the real effective groups in fighting SOPA and PIPA last year. He did something that was a little reckless, let's say. There is another database, kind of like the PACER database. Is called JSTOR. It's an academic journal database, and it charges money for access to academic journals. Now, these aren't quite exactly in the public domain. Some of these studies were paid for by federal funds. Some of the studies are academic and paid for by universities. But it's often been a bone of contention that this stuff, for society's sake, should be widely available. That the scientific journals, anybody should be able to access them, shouldn't have to pay for it. He was associated with Harvard. Harvard had an account with JSTOR. He used his legitimate account, but he did something JSTOR says you can't do, which is download in bulk. He, in fact, took a laptop, snuck it into MIT, put it in a closet in MIT.
Connected it.
And downloaded the entire database.
You want to think 20%?
Is it that little? I thought it was more. Anyway, well, I mean, gigabytes.
No, he took all of it, I think.
I don't know how much.
Yes, he took a lot.
JSTOR, when they caught him, actually, he turned himself in. JSTOR and MIT decided to prosecute. The feds, of course, said, yeah, we finally got this kid. Eventually, JSTOR backed down. In fact, an interesting thing, JSTOR just a few weeks ago decided to make all of that information public anyway. MIT, according to Lessig, was a little more equivocal in its backing down, giving the federal prosecutors, sufficient reason to continue forward. Aaron was facing 50 years in jail, a $4 million fine. The trial was to come in April. Now,
Totally disproportionate.
Yep. They were treating him like a terrorist.
They were trying to make an example out of him.
They implied that he was stealing this data to sell it, which he wasn't. He wanted to make it publicly available. However, he did break laws. Although
just not really 50 years worth of
not
laws.
50. Yeah. Now, Corey writes, Aaron was a person who had problems with depression for many years. He'd written about the subject publicly, talked about it with his friends. And, of course, there are many things that might cause a person to want to take his own life. But his friends, his family, and Larry Lessig do think that the unreasonable, disproportionate reaction of the federal government had something to do with it. The thought of being in prison for 50 years might have had something to do with it. So our deepest condolences to all who knew Aaron Swartz, to his family, to his partner. It is just a horrible tragedy. I don't think that it's really appropriate to say it's all the Fed's fault, but it's certainly appropriate to shine a light on their inappropriate prosecution. And I think it's a great loss for all of us. It's very sad.
I think one of the things we can take away, and there are an interesting couple of things that are happening. So academics are starting to post PDFs of some of their material and open sourcing it and put it on Twitter so that it's sort of like a tribute to, you know, make some information free. But I think one of the other things that we can really take away from this is, you know, on like kind of a serious and slightly grim note, is that mental health and depression is something that affects a lot of people. It affects a lot of people in the kind of geek and nerd community. Many of us kind of, you know, you can laugh it off as being a little bit, oh, I'm a bit antisocial because I'm a bit of a geek. But I think we all have a little bit of responsibility just to try and look after the people that are near us and try and try and get people to get help if they need it.
Now, Larry points out that Aaron had many friends in San Francisco, and he was beloved by many. He was not, somebody who was cut off from society. No. So I don't want to even speculate on what happened. The expert witness who was going to testify on his behalf, Alex Stamos, who is a computer security and forensic expert, called the case vindictive. He said that Aaron did not hack the JSTOR website. He just wrote, for any reasonable definition of hack, he wrote a handful of basic Python scripts that discovered the URLs of articles, then used curl to request them. He did not use parameter tampering. He did not break a CAPTCHA. He did not, do anything sneaky. He did not cover his tracks or hide his activity. The government provided no evidence that these downloads caused a negative effect on either JSTOR or MIT. It's very sad.
Beyond the tragedy of losing someone who was so intelligent, who was a visionary, who was actually fighting for the free information rights of anyone who's ever used an electronic resource, I think there's another story here, which is how desperate the DOJ and the federal government is to have some sort of strong case that establishes their version of copyright and property laws in the digital domain. We saw it with the defeat of SOPA and PIPA. We saw it with the bungled prosecution of Kim.com and Mega Upload, and we see it here.
Yeah,
and they're so desperate for a win that I think that's where that bully attitude comes into. We want to make an example out of you.
There's also a fear of technology that drives a little bit of this. I think some of the overreaction to hacking in general is this.
We've only
fear.
Got to look at the composition of, like, the Congressional Science Committee, which is full of people who don't believe in science.
I don't like science.
That's science not a great evil. Start. So I think, again, it's one of those things where I feel like changes in some of these cases is generational, that you get a new generation of lawmakers or a new generation of people in power, in government, in society, and attitudes change along with that. But there's always the guys that want to go down kicking and screaming on the way out.
Yeah. $1.1 billion. It's a new number. That is how much it's apparently Yahoo. We're going to find out tomorrow probably. Yahoo board, according to the Wall Street Journal, has agreed to pay for Tumblr.
All cash.
Mm. All cash? It's not a stock deal?
That's the word on the street, is that it's an all cash.
David Karp, who dropped out of high school to create the blogging platform. Tumblr's been a huge success. I fell in love with it very early. It just was such an easy way to create what, before Tumblr, was a genre called the Tumblelog. Mm. And it was hard to do in the early days. You had to get a template and all this stuff, and the Tumblr just made it very easy. And Karp raised, I think, $125 million to get a valuation of $800 million. But it's going, according to Kara Swisher, and if Kara says it's true, it must be, $1.1 billion. Is that a big number, O'Malik, or is it worth it?
It's not that big a number in larger scheme of things. It's like Yahoo wants to be relevant. What's $1 billion here? What's $1 billion there? And actually, if you really look at it, it doesn't cost them a lot of money because they are spending the money they're going to make from Alibaba IPO on stuff like Tumblr. So Alibaba valuation is going up pretty rapidly. And as a result of that, they're beginning to see pretty high. They have a lot more cash to play around with.
And
23% of Alibaba, and they want to sell half of it. And Alibaba's valuation right now is about $70 billion. And if when it goes public next year, it's going to be worth about $100 billion. So, their value, they will have a lot more cash to play with.
And these could pay off. Jason Calacanis sent out in his newsletter, he said, what, $1.1 billion? That's nothing. He says the people who are complaining about that are poor hourly employees at newspapers who aren't, for whom, this is a pretty big amount of money. He said, but for a company, Yahoo could buy 100 of these it's the payoff potential is huge. Look what Google got out of YouTube, which they paid only a few billion dollars for and is now worth probably, you know, 100 times that. So apologies to Dwight Silverman on behalf of Jason Calacanis.
I make almost that much, so I'm fine.
That was typical Jason, right? He immediately insults somebody before he can even make his point. But I think it was a good point, which is, while it sounds like a large number, anything with a B is going to get your attention. It's not that much money, even for a company like Yahoo that's struggling a little bit. And the opportunity for Yahoo is to be hip. Yeah. Is that right?
Totally. I mean, if you look at – and actually, as loath as I am to agree with Jason in some of his points, he did make the right assertion in his newsletter that was, kids aren't on Facebook anymore. They're on Tumblr.
Right.
Like teens, 20s, they live on Tumblr.
It's a lot like the Instagram acquisition. Yes. I think Facebook looked at Instagram and said, we could lose our shirt to this company because everybody under the age of 20 is Instagramming.
Yeah, I've noticed a marked change in the last 6 to 8 months where when a funny thing on the internet gets sent to me, it's on Tumblr.
It's Tumblr.
It's like, just this past week, a friend of mine sent the worst room on theworstroom.tumblr.com, and it's all photos from Craigslist of bad apartments in New York City, like $300 for a room in Brooklyn Heights or something like that.
It turns out Tumblr's a photo sharing site. We thought it was going to be about, sharing quotes or sharing links. It's a photo sharing site.
And my day job, I work in comic books. I work for a comic book publisher. So much art on Tumblr. So many artists posting stuff up. We'll have, like main comic book artists putting their stuff up on Tumblr before it gets up on anywhere else. Yeah, here's the worst room. This is this Tumblr's great. These are literally Craigslist listings in New York City for $750 in Williamsburg.
Oh. Yeah.
My friend James sent me this, and the thing is, this stuff used to be out there on WordPress, or it used to be out there.
It's
on
so
on
easy to do on
it's
Tumblr.
It's on Tumblr. It's in 2 seconds you have a site up like that. And me as a marketer, I'm using Tumblr. Is so easy to build a site very quickly, put up your branding, have an easy way for people to submit to you. Their submission engine is really elegant, really simple, and there's just millions of people playing around on it. So
when Rick Perry said he had binders full of women before the debate was over, there was a Tumblr. Binders full of women, which is now gone, by the way. And that's exactly what Tumblr's for. Well, it's an instant place that you could do this.
When TechCrunch did the little jam on Michaela's not impressed when the rumors were that Tumblr was going to reject the offer and they said Tumblr's not impressed.
Right.
That was
a play on Tumblr.
A play on Tumblr because the Michaela's not impressed from the Olympics was on Tumblr. So Tumblr really has quietly become the hot spot on the web for the younger generation. It's not Facebook. It's Tumblr.
By the way, I think John Constantine got that wrong. I think Tumblr was impressed. I'd be impressed.
Yeah. It's hard not to. Yeah. I mean. With that investment, only $125 million in, that's a great return.
Yeah.
So,
it was Mitt Romney, not Rick Perry. Did I say? Anyway, I confuse all those guys. They all have the same hair.
Well, Mormons do have binders full of women.
So, a good move for Marissa Meyer. Is this? It seems to me it's a good move. This is the kind of thing Marissa came to Yahoo to do.
Well, hey, I think it's.
Go ahead,
No, I made an assertion in one of my early posts. This is like a middle-aged guy hanging out with young people, trying to look hip. So, if they have to spend $1 billion to do it, why not?
But will it work?
I don't know. I think at least it's not a bad idea for them to do this. Though I feel that if they were spending this kind of money, they should have gone after a company like Pinterest, which is more along the lines of Yahoo's traditional strengths, which is more women use it, more brand centric and more wholesome in some sense of the word, and they could have made more money monetizing Pinterest much faster. But Tumblr is a good acquisition, definitely a great acquisition. I'm happy for David who. I remember him pitching me about Tumblr in 2007 in the early days of GigaOM at a coffee shop near my house. And we talked about how he wanted the whole thing to play out. And it has played out as he had planned.
Interesting.
In his early days. So pretty impressive.
He saw it going this way.
Yeah. I mean, not that he would get acquired by Yahoo. He was pretty clear about why people would share this certain way on the web.
And how old was he when you talked to him?
I can't remember. Man,
he was a kid.
Do the math.
Yeah, he
was like 7 years ago.
Yeah. So he'd be like 17 or 18. He was a kid.
And I guess the question now is, how bad will the exodus be? Because there's always
an exodus. Well, they say, now Kara says that they've got CARP for 4 years locked in.
Wow.
That they're going to have the same kind of autonomy that Instagram has at Facebook. The brand won't change. It'll still look like an independent entity. And I think that's really important. If it suddenly says Tumblr by Yahoo.
Or Tumblr with an exclamation point.
That's not going to go. That's not going to fly. And I don't think that the people who use Tumblr are that wired into who owns it as much as is this the easy-to-use platform. Yeah. But you're right. It's always risky when you buy something like that.
It's giving up your baby. But 4 years. I mean, Yahoo doesn't have the best track record with these acquisitions.
That's one thing Marissa has to really turn.
Exactly. Around. Yeah. That if it wasn't Marissa in the driver's seat, I'd be a little worried after Delicious and Flickr and all that.
Terry Semel doesn't go to David Karp and say, "Hey, we'll keep it exactly the same way, man. Yeah. We're not going to mess with it. We love Tumblr. It's going to be the same. We love you. You're beautiful, babe." I think that it's pretty clear that only Marissa could go to somebody like Dave. Yeah. Apparently, she did personally woo him considerably and really said, "Look, you're going to get complete autonomy. We're not going to take this over." So now it's a coincidental, I think, but tomorrow is a big announcement from Yahoo. Dwight, do we know what they're going to say tomorrow? It's not about Tumblr.
Supposedly, it's about Flickr, but I suspect that Tumblr will play into it if the deal has been done today. There is, I think, someone mentioned the idea of the exodus, and he was talking about talent, but I think you also got to think about an exodus of users, because if people are freaking out over over the idea of Yahoo's culture versus Tumblr's culture, you could promise autonomy, but the first time, say, that a big media company comes to Yahoo and says, "Hey, you know, they're putting copyrighted material on there. Can you take it off, please? You own it now." And Yahoo puts the Bigfoot on some hot meme. That is really going to kind of kill off, immediately will kill off the goodwill that it has with its users. There's already a BuzzFeed item up there about people on Tumblr who are already putting Tumblogs up about Yahoo, and so
how long?
This is it, right?
Well, yeah, and that's right. With such a young audience base, they're gonna cry sell out. They're gonna cry, and
if
then
they even hear about. Well, I guess
well,
they're
gonna hear.
Well,
at that
price, they know about it. Yeah. They know about it.
Slate created on Friday after the close of Google Reader, or the announced close of Google Reader, the Google Graveyard. It's hard to lose a loved one, especially if that loved one is a Google service. You can plant flowers on the graves and let the healing process begin. Like, I'm going to plant a flower on Google Reader. That'll make 32,574 flowers. iGoogle, not so much. Google Labs, yeah, I kind of miss Google Labs. Google Wave, not so much. Google Video, yeah. Google Desktop, no. In fact, Google had a lot of crap, didn't they?
Google Video got subsumed into YouTube.
It's that was YouTube. A sad
it's
thing.
That. It's like,
actually, you know what? I'm going to put a flower on that grave too. Isn't this good?
Who made this site?
This is from Slate.
Also, great. Man, Google, really, like, this is this.
How was that?
Wow.
There's a lot of stuff here I know. Google Fast Flip.
Yeah, not so many flowers on that one. It's interesting. You can really tell.
Is Frugal on there?
Oh, I'm sure Frugal's here. Let's see. There's Null.
Frugal.
Jaiku. Oh, I got to put a flower on Jaiku.
Oh, Jaiku.
Yeah.
I totally remember when everybody was doing that for like a week.
And here, look, they've already dug the grave for Google Glass.
That is not cool at all.
That's amazing.
That's great.
That is also S-bull. I heart Google Glass. I can't even wait for that.
Really?
I don't know why I haven't had
really,
that.
Molly Wood? Really? You're going to go around wearing it. First of all, you don't wear glasses.
Nope.
So you're going to wear glasses just so you can do that.
Yep.
Many of us had LASIK surgery, wear contacts, have gone to great expense not to wear glasses.
Yeah, I wear contacts too.
Yeah.
Contacts.
Yeah. So Google is so persuasive that you're now going to go back to wearing glasses?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that retinal implant is coming.
And you know what will happen when I'm wearing those glasses? I will totally set myself apart as like a member of the awesome.
Yeah, because nobody's going to let you into anywhere. You won't be able to go to a bar, a gym, a club. They're going to say, glass. Really,
it's true. The privacy.
I don't go
and
to any of those places anyway.
Yeah, you're just going to be at home and with your cat.
Yeah, I don't have a cat.
You mean my phones.
Yeah, with my life companions. I'm just going to be doing my normal thing with my life companions.
I can't wait for the first twit where the entire panel, including me, because I have the reservation, is wearing glass. And we're all looking a little bit off camera to the right and up and distracted.
Yeah.
That's going to be.
It's not going to be the snappiest conversation.
No. And Google announced the first apps now for Google Glass, which make no sense at all. The New York Times.
Yeah, they really make no sense.
Come on. I'm not going to.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to consume media. The only apps I want are the ones that are currently part of the Google Now cards, because those Google Now cards
is cool.
Rock my world. Right. Like, I love how that phone, it knows me so well, my life companion. Yeah. It will pop up a little thing that says, like, it'll be like, hey, sweetie, I thought you need to know that there's a traffic jam during your commute hour.
Wait,
so you
I
might
have
want
a question.
To get a little extra
so, Molly,
time.
And that's
Molly,
what that's what they're just, doing.
Yeah.
Let me just ask
that's
you this.
What they're doing. So they built
mind,
the whole UI.
I want that.
Wait, Molly, so in your mind, your Google Now's voice is a very well-meaning, like, Minnesotan mother.
Hey, honey.
That's what I heard. Hey,
not,
sweetie.
Not, no, it's her
just
mother.
I want you to know that there's a special on soup.
That's your mother. That's her mother.
So, sweetie, you know, I went ahead and I got you a Frappuccino because I know you're going to be in the car for a while.
Yeah. I got it. I see what Google Now's doing for you. It's cool. Hey, did you wear a blazer today? It's going to be
are you? Are you from Minnesota, Molly?
North Dakota. I went to high school in North Dakota.
Oh my God, you are Fargo. Yeah.
Oh, I come by it honestly. You know, this is not not put on. This is the real me.
You actually do look like you could be wearing a parka, and I could see you there.
Oh heck yeah, I can shovel your driveway in about 10 minutes flat there if you need me to.
Got it.
It's a thing.
That's great.
Wow.
It's true that whenever I emulate any kind of caring voice, it always comes out that way.
It's your mother. That's why.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Don't you know? It's my mom.
Does your mom watch all your shows?
Oh, heck no.
Does she even know what you do?
Not totally. Sometimes when I put it on the Facebook, she'll go ahead and like it.
She does that computer thing. It's I don't know what she's in the California now. Yeah, doing that computer thing.
My parents only engage with what I do when I go on CNN.
Yeah.
Like, it's something that I've learned. It's,
well, that's real media. That's why Joanna Stern's parents are so damn proud.
I will say that I get a lot of emails from my parents' friends.
We saw you on TV. You were fabulous.
We saw you talking about a phone in a cab. Hear that a lot.
Totally. That's amazing.
New York Times... Evernote, again, yeah, something I don't really want to look at.
Evernote would be helpful.
I guess if it's send to Evernote, like send that to Evernote.
It does.
Send that to Evernote. That's
the
gesture.
Okay, Glass. Yeah. Send to Evernote.
I want to remember this one. That's what you do.
Add that chick to my Evernote. Put her in.
That would be awesome.
Hotties.
And if I was like I have an Evernote list for wines I like. So if I'm at the store and I can just be like,
oh, yeah,
you know, pull me up.
That's good.
Yeah. Evernote's useful. Yeah.
You'll be that crazy person in the aisle.
Yes.
waving at wine.
Talking to himself, waving. Yeah, yeah, I like that wine. That's good wine. I like that wine. Definitely good wine. Definitely good wine.
He keeps doing this.
That's what you do. You wipe you swipe your temple, don't you?
Yeah, there's a touch sensor in the temple.
Yeah. Well, I'm not making it up. I've seen people, crazy people, do that.
I'm now swiping you off the screen.
But the glasses, see, the problem, you're confusing it with if I had the implant. Then that would look weird.
Ooh, I would
then
like
I would
the
be
implant.
Waving and moving my eyes. But if I have the glasses, they immediately mark me as a member of the Digerati.
And they're so very attractive.
Whatever. Now,
if they put it in a hat, I'd wear it. I like hats. So Evernote, New York Times, Gmail, so you can get your mail. That's good. And Path, so you
and
can
path.
Let your imaginary friends know what you're doing. It's good for taking pictures of food.
Let your three friends on Path know.
Yeah. I'm your friend. I'm your friend on Path.
I was excited about Path because then it would remind me that I have to use Path.
You never post on Path, Joanne.
I never post on Path.
Well, I'm following you and expecting something. I want something. I want to see a picture of something. Just put a picture.
When I get my glass, I'll remember to use it.
Maybe that'll be suddenly everybody will be hot air ballooning and taking kayak rides through the rapids. Yeah. It'll be so great.
No, everything, if you're a social network user and you live in California, you're always having adventures.
Right.
It's just the way it goes.
That somebody That's said that. It's going to be the photo record of the 1%.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, that is hurtfully true.
Yeah.
That's exactly what that's
Rich Kids on Instagram is going to be revolutionized by Google Glass.
I love Rich Kids on Instagram, by the way. That is so awesome. I love Rich Kids on Instagram. That is so, so funny. I wonder if that account is still active today. That was a little while ago. That was episode 397. I hope you're enjoying this look back at 2013, our best of episode. We do this every year in the Christmas, during Christmas week. Let people go home a little bit early and enjoy the holidays with family and friends. I hope you're enjoying your holidays. Next week, TWIT will be on at its regularly scheduled time. That's Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2300 UTC. On twit.tv. So I hope you'll stop by and watch us live. If not, though, as always, on-demand audio and video of this show and every show we've ever done available at twit.tv and wherever finer podcasts are aggregated. Coming up, of course, this was the year that we found out what the NSA was up to. We'll talk about Prism and roosters in just a moment. But first, a word from our great sponsor, SumAll. We got to know Dane Atkinson when he was a principal at Squarespace. Really smart, neat guy. After he left Squarespace, he was looking for his next big thing, and he came up with SumAll. You know, most big businesses have something called business analytics or business intelligence, BI, that allow them to, you know, use big data to find out, you know, how things are going, to project into the future. But it's been a long time. You know, this has been around for a long time, but it's never been something that normal people like you and me could do until now. SumAll is an amazing free product that lets you get insights from all the data surrounding what you're up to, your blog, your podcast, your business. You can connect data streams from Amazon, PayPal, eBay, Authorize.net, Google Analytics, Google AdWords, Shopify if you sell online, Bing, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, MailChimp, Google Plus, AdSense, SendGrid. I can go on and on. They recently added Instagram and Foursquare and Tumblr and Blogger, Moz, Stripe, if that's your credit card service company. All your transactions will be available. Braintree, BigCommerce. So you can take a look at, you know, how things are selling, how your social campaigns impact that. You can look at traffic. Much better analytics than you get anywhere else. Very sophisticated integration with related data streams, personalized daily or weekly emails. I love getting my SumAll email every week. It really tells me how TWIT's doing and how the marketing campaigns and other things we're doing are working. You can get an export or spreadsheet view. Dozens of features for free. There's even a SumAll mobile app for the iPhone that will give you literally real-time data on your online store's performance, for instance. Historical stats. You could track revenue, units sold, discount patterns. Android app on its way. This is a great service. And best of all, it's free. Visit SumAll.com. SumAll.com slash. Nope, no slash. Just SumAll.com. And sign up for free today. Connect it up. Chad's been using it. We've been using it. It really is. It, you know, this is the kind of information big business has always had, or has at least for the last decade. But now it's available to all of us. SumAll.com. Try it free today. You're watching our best of episode, our traditional year ender, where we take a look at what happened, some of the biggest stories, some of the funniest moments. We're going to talk about roosters, John C. Dvorak. This was a pick from Jeremy Radwan and David Kroll and Jonathan Ellis. They loved these moments. But before we do that, let's talk big news stories. Probably the biggest news story of all in 2013, the Edward Snowden leaks and what we learned about the NSA. Let's watch. So yeah. Welcome, everybody. Nice to have you. We got the overflow room filled up, too. And a good day to be here because this is going to be a very interesting topic. Now, I know a lot of people say it's a tech show. We don't want you to talk about politics. And I don't know if we are talking about politics. There's a lot of tech in this story. It broke this week. Glenn Greenwald, who is a blogger, worked for Salon for a while. I'm going to take off the tinfoil hat if you don't mind. My thoughts can now emanate freely. It's actually quite hot. it's a very warm device. He is a former lawyer. Do you know Glenn? Because I don't know him. Glenn very well. I've been reading him for a while. He's kind of focused on security.
Yeah.
He wrote for Salon for a while, now writes for The Guardian. Broke a very big story with a PowerPoint presentation, a 41-slide PowerPoint presentation that talked about how the NSA, we almost felt like a marketing presentation. In fact, some people said, this couldn't be real. It's like a a marketing presentation.
Yeah, and that's what it felt like.
Did you go through the 41 slides?
The 41 slides aren't released. There's only like four or five.
He only showed a few of them.
Yeah, what's the point of that?
A few blurry ones.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn's going to maximize this, right?
I don't know about that. We go through the chronology of the story.
All right.
I don't know about that.
So the first thing that we learn from these slides is that data collection was happening. That the slides implied that Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and others, with the notable exception of Twitter,
Skype,
giving the NSA. Privileged security of their servers.
Mm-hmm. Direct access.
Direct access.
It's a key phrase in this entire affair.
And frankly, I think we don't really know what that means. I think that there's two ways to interpret it. And in fact, it's a litmus test on where your politics lie, how you interpret this. So Larry Page of Google's first blog response was a blog post that said, "What the... we do not allow government access to our servers. We respond to government requests for information.
Right.
We vet them with our lawyers. We fight as many as we can. And when we cannot fight it, we give it to them. And we do so on," did he say this? "On a special server that we've arranged with them."
No, he didn't say that.
He didn't say that. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, same thing. We don't do this.
Very much the same thing. And before anybody even, start talking about this, everybody needs to understand that the laws that allow this say that nobody... It's like Fight Club.
You're not supposed to
talk. First rule, you don't talk about it. Nobody's allowed by law to talk about it. So most of the stuff that we've heard is probably colored by the fact that everybody's trying not to break the law.
A lot of these requests for information come from national security letters, most of which, 97% of which as written, prevent the recipient from saying anything at all.
Well, but so the really important thing that we don't know about this whole story is that the original story published in The Guardian by Glenn Greenwald and in The Washington Post, there were simultaneous stories, basically alleged, and I believe the last line of the Post story, I don't remember if it was Greenwald's story or the Post story, the last line was, they can watch you live type your search queries, right? That's the level of access they have. They have direct access to these servers, whatever's on them, all of your information that's there, they can see it. Now, that story has been getting softer and softer and softer until now we're talking about national security letters. We're talking about, they have specific requests for information. The metadata stuff is like, it's out there. There is also another story, which I think has been conflated somewhat, where there was a lawsuit filed against Verizon and they were ordered to turn over some metadata, which is not part of this FISA stuff. So there's a lot going on, but the core allegation is the government has direct, and this is the key piece, direct access to the servers of these enormous cloud computing companies, and they can monitor them in real time.
So the way to think about this from a technology point of view as opposed to a political one is that big data has come to the security world. Mm-hmm. They're using big data to do security. And what that means is they're hoovering up, as they say in the UK, all the data, all the metadata, whatever it is that they're getting, and they're processing it the way Google processes data in massive, huge scale. And they're, slicing and dicing it, and they're filtering it and figuring out what's going on. So it's a really, really interesting glimpse into where everything is going. Everything is going toward big data. And this happens to be a security.
Right. And the question, I think the problem is, that's great. You want the law enforcement community to be making use of the tools, right? You want them to catch the bad guys. The question is, what data are they using to catch the bad guys? How much of our data are they using? And what are the constraints upon their acquisition and retention of that data? And we don't have any of those answers, like not a single one. And right now where the story is, and this is why I said I don't know if the rest of the slides are coming out, right now the story has landed at The Guardian, The Washington Post made these incredible accusations. The industry has denied them. The government has said, your senators and your lawmakers, they all know about it, both parties, all the intelligence committees, they keep approving it. This is just as the same as ever. And there's no evidence on either side to prove which allegation is true. And then The Guardian today pivoted their story from this pile of evidence they say they have to the person who's presented the evidence.
And I'm talking about Edward Snowden, this whistleblower.
And I think that's really fascinating. And I don't know why you would, if you have this collection of smoking guns, why you would suddenly turn to the leaker instead of the evidence.
Again, we can only say we don't know.
I don't know.
Do you suppose that that's because of pressure from the government to back down or because they realized they didn't have a story?
I don't know. I don't know. And my instinct is to be as negative as possible and to say that the government definitely has this access. They can't talk about it because I don't know why they wouldn't want this access. And I don't know why.
So what
in the culture of secrecy that we have, especially around terrorism, why they wouldn't make use of every like legal and political angle to get the access. They would do it.
So Claire Kane Miller, writing in the New York Times, said in at least two cases, Google and Facebook, one of the plans discussed was to build separate secure portals, like a digital version of the secure physical rooms that have long existed for classified information, in some instances on company servers. So it would be a Google server, for instance. Through these online rooms, the governments would request data, companies would deposit it, the government would retrieve it. That seems like a reasonable procedure. In fact, probably a more secure procedure than emailing it or sending them a box of documents.
I think you'd want
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So the question is that what's happening or do they really have this backdoor access? And no one knows, and it really comes down to what you believe.
Yeah, and I think what was so interesting is all these statements came out from the tech companies and they were so similar.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So similar. I mean, I sat down, I highlighted them, and it was like
interesting.
It was
like
so
somebody
similar.
Wrote it for them.
Well,
or that they coordinated it, or that they were very careful with the language.
I think you're if you're a Silicon Valley general counsel, I think you probably know all the other Silicon Valley general counsels.
Right. What are we going to say, guys?
Yeah, and I think you just have that phone call.
And Larry Page did it.
I don't think there's anything ominous.
It was not from Larry Page. It was from Larry Page and Google's top
senior
lawyer.
Counsel.
And so that tells me that Larry Page is worried about actually breaking the law. He's worried about covering his behind. Why else would you co-write a message about, you know, your company not doing something with coming from
a lawyer whispering in your ear?
Well, it was from both of them.
I mean, Larry Page was probably like, we should just move everybody to the island.
Okay, well, let's start with what law are we talking about that they're breaking? They take all the email and by the way.
Starting with the Fourth Amendment. The
Fourth Amendment says the government cannot
search and seizure.
That's the government. These are private companies. They can do whatever they want.
They can do whatever they want.
And that's what they're doing. So, why wasn't anybody complaining, for example, when they came out with, all your email that's 180 days old, it's good to go? Which you remember when that happened? You talked about on the show, or the one that really
but
gets
that was,
me.
That was a federal law.
It was leading to this, and the other one, which really cracks me up. Is, we're going to give AT&T, Verizon, and everybody else immunity from all past crimes, which means the wiretapping laws.
Right.
Nobody bitched then. But now, because of this, everyone's complaining.
Remember in 2006, the NSA whistleblower said, I was in a closet. There's a special room at AT&T headquarters in San Francisco. What was his name? Binny. And this is all AT&T stuff.
And he said this was going on then.
Now, the president said, we're not listening to phone calls. We're not reading emails.
And they're not.
We are watching the movement. We are looking at phone numbers.
Trends.
We're watching trends.
Yeah.
There is a lot of information.
What law
there,
is being broken by Google? You said there was a law being broken.
The risk of breaking the law by even talking about it.
Yeah, there's one law.
They've already fought the national security letters. In fact, Google's the only one to stand up to these things. Mm-hmm. Microsoft, if you listen to their commentary, they said, we're not volunteering anything, which means they got a national security letter, and so they're forced to give this information over.
They're not, by the way, nobody's forced.
No law being broken
nobody's
here.
Forced to put up a private room for the NSA, but
there's not
there's
against
no
the law.
Not to do it.
Well, no, I mean, like, you know, Twitter
has a big difference between giving them the fire hose.
Right.
Twitter won't do it. They said, we're not going to help.
But it's not clear that Twitter's been asked.
Yeah, but Twitter sells the fire hose. I mean, that's what they're holding out for.
Seriously,
you can buy the fire hose from them.
Well,
not a direct message.
That's like public tweets, right? I mean, Twitter gets routinely asked for data. I cover the Twitter gets asked for data by rogue governments.
Twitter goes to the library.
Not direct messages. So there is private stuff on Twitter. I don't think the FBI or the NSA wants the public tweets. They can get that.
Right.
What they want is the DMs.
Well,
right?
They can get a
Twitter
lot of information
so
from
great.
Public tweets.
It's like not perfect.
And since we're talking about who's giving up what, I read something that said that 98% of the data is coming from Facebook, Google.
Yeah.
And one other company.
Well, Twitter's a broadcast platform, right? I mean, like, it's one to many inherently, so I think people know.
Definitely not PalTalk.
Yeah, probably not PalTalk.
Well, so PalTalk was, like, apparently really heavily used during the Arab Spring.
It's used in certain parts of the world.
There's a link to that there.
I think we're talking about the rule that they would be broken here is that the rule or the law that they can't talk about this.
Yeah, my understanding. Yeah, my understanding is that there's a law within FISA that says. Yes. You have to comply,
and you
if
can't.
You're a private company.
But there's
and
no law. There's no law that says you have to really stand around vigorously denying it. Right? There's no law that compels
you're
some positive.
To shut up is what right? you're supposed
what
to
they
do.
All said is we've never heard of prison.
Yeah, but,
so you know it's a buzzword that they didn't hear. Right. It's the word. And then
yeah, it doesn't mean anything.
Wait, hold on. I mean, you can ascribe negative intention to all the companies involved. You can ascribe
Mike
negative intention.
Called them cowards.
You can call them cowards. You can ascribe negative intention to the government. But the step you take where you say now everyone is coordinating this legalistic language mm-hmm. to dance around the truth, I don't – that is the leap to conspiracy theory.
Okay, so here's the part that you can agree with that where there's wrongdoing. The EFF wrote a really compelling piece on this. They apparently in 2011, the FISA court apparently found – that the whole thing was a part of this enforcement of this of FISA was unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
So EFF filed a Freedom of Information Act thing to get the details on that, and they were blocked by the Obama administration, who
sure.
said no, only the FISA court can release that, and then the court said only Obama can release
this.
That. So I think we can all agree that. There's not enough transparency about what's going on.
No, I totally agree with that. But what I don't agree with, and I think this is where we're reading these statements and these denials and parsing every word is that there's some hidden meaning there. Mm-hmm. I think that misses the point because the point is that we need transparency for the government.
Mm-hmm.
I think the companies involved are telling us everything that they can. And if they're not allowed to disclose their participation in some programs, I think they're avoiding saying that. But I don't think they're actively colluding with the government to hide things. I think that is one step too far. And I think if the EFF isn't afraid of the Obama administration and will file lawsuits to do things, I have no ability to understand why Google would be afraid of the government. If Google could say it and the worst that would happen to them is they would get a lawsuit and David Drummond would have to spend some more time in federal court.
You have to make up your mind. They're either afraid of the government or they're not afraid of the government.
I don't think they are.
I don't either. I think they're colluding. There has to be one or the other.
Why would they collude?
Why not? It's so easier. It's not a matter of – I don't know that this list comes from way left field.
Yeah.
Maybe after 9/11 – of course, remember George Bush started his secret.
By the way, none of these companies existed then.
Right. The warrantless wiretaps started October 9/11. October 9/11.
Facebook didn't exist.
They have Hotmail on the. They have
Hotmail. Didn't exist.
We too.
A lot of these companies
AOL did.
Isn't it?
Google did.
Doesn't the federal government feel like it has a silent mandate from the American people to protect it at all costs? And if that means monitoring cell phone traffic, particularly traffic from the U.S. to overseas, if it means monitoring emails, what's wrong with that?
That's what I say.
Well, here's
really in agreement with you.
Yeah,
oh, I must be on the wrong
here's
side.
Here's what's wrong with it. Here's what's wrong with it. So, assuming the general accusation is accurate that they're gobbling up all the metadata to find out who's talking to whom, and then from that they're figuring out what to get a warrant for to mm-hmm. go in deep. That's the accusation, and that is clearly unconstitutional. The
fishing expedition
because the Fourth Amendment specifically talks about you can't do fishing expeditions. They can't go through your house to see if there's anything illegal
going
on in
your
house.
Here's one of the things going on according to Binney, and I think this is true. And all you have to do is look at that Utah facility that the NSA is building.
A million square foot
facility.
They're
going to record every phone call you've ever made all in real time, and they're going to save it all. They're not going to be listening to your calls just like Obama said. They're going to save every call, and then they'll get a warrant when they think of something
right.
that was because you're a terrorist, let's say. And they'll be able to grab old calls.
They may not even save it. I mean, they're encouraging ISPs to do this, right? ISPs are supposed to have 18 months of your internet activity. They're probably getting help from the phone companies. It's probably being
terabytes
saved in many places.
Well, here's the craziest thing about all of this.
55.
This is Minority Report. This is about pre-crime.
Right.
They're building psychic robot, genetically engineered humans in form of computers to prevent crimes before they happen. It's amazing.
Well,
not buying this.
That's what they're trying to do.
I mean, I think there's a long history of our government working in cooperation with the phone companies. So the phone, saying
they're immunity.
Right. They've given them immunity. If you pick up a landline phone, the government has been able to tap that since like the 40s. Mm-hmm. Right. So And there's an expectation. I mean, it's in popular culture that if you, mm-hmm. you know, people are using burner phones on the wire because they know that the right. landlines are tapped.
Right.
What I think is interesting is many of the companies involved, I won't say all of them, but many of them have publicly said, we are not cooperating in this way. We're only doing what's legally required of us. And what the government has not said is what they deem to be legally required of these companies. And that's the only disconnect here, is the Google and Facebook, all this coordinated responses. They're saying what they have to say. They're saying we're doing what's legally required of us, and we're doing our best to not overstep that. Now, the question is, and the accusation is, they're doing more and they're not telling you about it. And the government is demanding more than you think is reasonable. And nobody knows if that's true
or
not.
Was that an error to say that that the government can watch in real time your transactions?
Maybe they can. You got to think somebody at Google can.
Google for surely can.
Well, don't you remember the one search engine that used to have the real-time searches flying
Google
by?
Google has that Google in the lobby. That they still do, yeah.
The government can do that for sure, but it's the Chinese government.
According to IBM, every day we create 2.5 quintillion bytes of data.
Yeah. Did you just Google
it? It's a lot of storage.
Yeah. No,
it's a rare peek behind the scenes of Twitter.
I had seen this number before, and I was trying to find it. 90% of the data in the world today has been created in the last 2 years alone. So you better have a big-ass hard drive.
Yeah.
Million square feet of servers.
2.5 right? quintillion bytes.
I think it's going to be awesome. I mean, Google has the entire internet stored. The State Department had the internet in a box, which was most of the internet stored in a suitcase.
12 terabytes of tweets a day.
Let's leave those
terabytes
out.
So much valuable information in those tweets, too.
I had a really good sandwich this morning.
Yeah.
Well, in regards to the metadata, I want to tell an anecdote, which I've told before, and I'll tell it again. In the 90s, this was going on. I was in London at a PC Magazine UK event where we were being shown certain kinds of new technologies that were being developed by Interpol. And Interpol showed, this is a network analysis, they showed, here's what we can do. We can take all these phone calls, the metadata, who called who, how long it lasted, and the rest of it. And then he showed us this crazy network map. He says, we can spot a crime boss using this data because we can see who's, you know, just based on the way they call each other and how long the calls last.
Apparently, it's only 5 points of data needed to actually identify somebody.
So, by the way, this
that wouldn't surprise
kind of metadata.
And we had a piece. One of our writers, Josh Kopstein, wrote a great piece. Is metadata is dangerous,
right?
And it's
viewed by the government as something that does not require a warrant.
Right.
Their portal. Every cell company has a portal for law enforcement of any kind for $1.50 to find out where you are.
The phone companies. Again, the phone companies. If you want to talk about companies who collude with the government,
yeah.
I mean, well, AT&T was granted a monopoly on building infrastructure in this company,
but remember Echelon? Remember we talked for a long time.
And that building still in San Francisco.
Echelon was never admitted to by the United States, but was admitted to by the British government as a joint program of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and the US to basically scan all electronic signal, which means email, phones, everything, for keywords.
Yeah.
You say hummus and bomb in the same sentence.
Boom.
Boom.
Who else but a terrorist would say hummus?
That's my favorite type of hummus.
It's delicious.
Yeah. Hummus bomb.
It's
delicious.
Who's had a hummus bomb?
It's the bomb.
Oh, God. We're all going to hell. Or Hong Kong, one or the other.
Yeah. It's my favorite sandwich.
Is it true that there's no extradition from Hong Kong?
That's absolutely not true.
That's what I thought. I don't know why this guy's there.
So here's my
paranoid conspiracy theory.
Where do you go if you don't? Just not
okay, Leo.
Dude, I was a copyright attorney. You think I know the answer to that question? So,
you could look it up. I think Paraguay. I think Argentina. I think maybe Uruguay.
I'm figuring Belize, but here's why McAfee's there.
Belize also has like the Babes, which is why McAfee is there.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't give the government enough money, you can get in trouble.
So. I did a post on this that I think somehow the Chinese government has got to be behind the leak and the timing of the leak because it was so beautiful for them. Yeah. Obama was just scheduled to go take premier of China, the president of China, out on the carpet for their hacking.
Spank him.
You can be the backup guy for no agenda.
It's just
timing is perfect.
This stuff has been going on for years, and the story breaks 3 days before Obama's about to lecture hacking.
He had to respond to it while he's talking to the Chinese premier.
They both got together and said, let's talk about the climate.
In Palo Alto, yeah.
Yeah, but again, it's a good conspiracy rises to the.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's just a lot of fodder here.
Yeah.
All I want to know, here's what I want to know. Can the government look at my Google search queries as I type them.
And why do you care?
And well, I do care. I mean, like why, that, that really, I care about.
Why do you care?
I think that leads. Look, our lives are now led online, right? They're right. wholly led online.
Shouldn't you just presume that, is an that impermissible everything you're doing intrusion. Online is public?
No. The same way you shouldn't assume only that everything you do in your home is public. I mean, there is no.
I know what Neil is searching
and
for.
We, yeah. Well, I've searched for a lot of super weird. Let's just be clear.
You know, the only thing that anybody's ever said in regards to this, the only risk that anybody's ever mentioned is that insurance companies might deny you insurance because you search for donuts.
But that's not the risk.
What is the risk?
That's not the bad risk.
That is
the
risk.
The risk is that we pride ourselves in this country on freedom of expression, on freedom of thought, on radical innovation, right? This whole valley around us is prided on weird ideas becoming reality.
Right.
And if we are constantly monitoring everyone, we will clamp down on that. There will be a chilling effect. And you cannot tell me, and we have, I think we've actually done a disservice to ourselves as participants in like the tech community. You can't tell me where the line between your offline life and your online life begins and where that boundary should be and where it is for everyone. We don't talk about it because it's not important, quite frankly, right?
But
it's
really,
only important now when the government is watching everything you do in one part of your life and there's an entire set of restrictions and constraints on the other
practically,
side.
Practically, really, why is it a chilling effect?
Are you
going to not search for something because the government's collecting your searches?
It depends on.
Presumably, your ISP and Google are doing it all.
Start now, Leo, and for the next couple of weeks, search for IED.
Do you share everything you do on Facebook?
No.
Why?
Because it's public. Same as anything else I do on the internet.
But so, would you search for IEDs?
No.
Okay.
Is that a chilling effect?
No, but,
yeah. What makes one?
But why is it that you wouldn't post everything?
I would search for IEDs if I wanted to know about IEDs.
Yeah.
Why is it that
you think
they
would come knocking on my door because I search for IEDs?
I think so.
Well, I think we should all search for IEDs and just overwhelm
law enforcement.
Have the chat
room do it.
Yeah.
That'll take care of a lot of problems.
And I'm on your network, so.
Yeah. Well, let's all do it then. Might as well.
Yeah. But I don't understand. Why do you feel less comfortable posting
but
things
is there any
to your in public for you on Facebook is a network of your fans and people who are invested in your welfare.
Do you have evidence that the government is now going out and prosecuting?
I don't have
people
evidence of anything
because of their
searches.
That's
actually my big problem here is I don't have evidence of anything.
But like because I don't think any exists.
I have four slides out of a PowerPoint deck.
No, I understand, but there's no example right now of somebody the government knocking on your door because of your Google searches.
I think there are many examples. Through history, overzealous police actions being taken because
I agree, but we don't. But are you saying
no? In the United States of America, you know, we have a high rate of false accusations. We have a high rate of like people being killed, like you know, executed for crimes they didn't commit, like higher than we should.
Right?
Why would we allow the government to start monitoring everything? Like, unless you can prove to me that law enforcement in this country is perfect. Which maybe you
so
can.
How do you,
I hope
no,
you can.
I can't. So how do you balance
but why would
then,
I give them the benefit of the doubt?
How do you balance then the need for security, which I guess we after 9/11 we'd agree we need something.
I think we just – I mean it's the same as – look, the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment conversation in this country is not like a new conversation.
Right. It's a long standing.
What's new about it is it's happening online now.
Right.
And the technology community has long said don't regulate the internet. Stay the hell away from it. Right, so laws like CISPA, you and I got into a big argument at SOPA once upon a time.
Right.
Those we shout down these laws instead of saying what they should be and how they should work. And
that was
in
your
response,
position was that instead of trying to say no SOPA, we should come up with a good law.
Yeah, we should come up with something that works that balances our interests correctly.
Right.
Because that's not happening, we employ spies. As taxpayers in the United States of America, we employ thousands upon thousands of spies.
Right.
They are meant to do spying.
Well, and
they're going to figure it out.
And that's
whether or not we give them the tools or not. What we need to do is give them the tools and set the limits transparently, which we're not doing.
You guys are funny.
Yeah.
They try.
We're hilarious.
Funny how?
We're hilarious.
Do I amuse you?
Yeah.
Funny looking?
Funny looking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
No, it's funny.
Yeah.
You should do the show live sometime. Don't be on the Skype.
Well, are you in New York, Lauren?
I'm in New York.
Yeah.
They must drag you out here once in a while.
Yeah, I'm out about once a month. I'm moving to the West Coast.
Bring her on the show
when
she's in town.
You're moving to the West Coast?
Yeah.
San Francisco?
Yeah, the Bay Area, I think.
Consider Petaluma.
Consider the East Bay.
You know, just in time for
otherwise
butter
you go
and egg.
Broke.
Butter and Egg Day. Now, there's a little issue with Butter and Egg Day.
Why is that?
Because it's Butter and Eggs Day, but they have the founding fathers, the city fathers have decided to rename it to Butter and Egg Days.
This is this.
Oh, so they just moved
you were
the
talking
S?
About Petaluma?
Yeah.
So now it's a singular egg.
We talked about
egg.
This idiotic
one
thing
egg,
before.
But on 2 days. Exactly. Yeah.
There we go.
It's very annoying.
And share the egg, ladies and gentlemen.
What's
of
the
Petaluma.
Origin of it? Why is there a butter and egg?
So
egg?
Petaluma, which is a small town about 55,000 an hour north of San Francisco.
Giant metropolises in the 1850s.
It was a very bustling city.
True. It's a fact.
Because we were
fact.
About the northernmost point of the San Francisco Bay. So lumber, gold, food, and stuff was brought to this point and then shipped down to San Francisco and points south. But the real reason for Butter and Eggs Day, because we're kind of in an agricultural area, is that in the 1900s, in Russia, Jewish people were being killed in pogroms by the Tsar. This is prior to communist Russia. And do-gooders here said, we need to save these. So they were getting Jews out of Russia in the 1900s. And the problem was you had all these basically peasants. They were agricultural Jews. And they said, what are we going to have them do? And it turned out it was very capital, low capital, very easy to set up chicken farms. Mm-hmm. So they were setting these Jews up that they'd brought in from Russia with chicken farms. And so there, this was a huge chicken area, and they're still beautiful old
wood chicken.
Is this
documented anywhere?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I know this used to be known for chickens.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah.
And we were the
awesome
number.
That's a history lesson, Leo.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. And there's still a lot of descendants from that. And well, we had a farm for a while with a chicken coop, with two chicken coops, who were the original 1900 chicken coops.
Big giant chicken coops?
No, they're huge. They're beautiful.
You should have put some chickens in it.
I refinished the floor. We fixed it up. It was a beautiful place. I was
and
thinking
now
that I was going
to. You're going to move in to the chicken coop. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. We have chickens.
I am already, Leo.
You have chickens? Well, there is a rule. It's still in the ordinances. Ordinance. That's not right. Yeah, ordinances, not ordinance. Ordinance.
Yes.
Of the city of Petaluma. That you cannot, no C's and C's, no covenants in any housing project anywhere in Petaluma can prevent you from having a chicken.
Yeah.
So, in fact, it's by law you have the right to have a chicken farm here.
You have the right in Berkeley.
Berkeley, too.
But in Albany, they charge you have to pay a $150 license fee for each chicken. Nobody does this.
Wait, per chicken?
Yes, it's a scam.
That's crazy.
There's an actual chicken counter from the city who comes around?
Yeah, that's the drawback.
I interviewed,
cities,
when I worked on KNBR 20 years ago, the last chicken sexer of Petaluma.
Is that the guy who checks the sex?
When a chick is born, it's very difficult to know if it's a hen or a cock.
This is content.
And there are people watching.
I'm already.
Here we go. Hen and cock
and this
talk
guy,
on Twitch.
This guy could tell. I asked him, and he wasn't very explicit, but he was.
Because he didn't want you taking his job.
He was highly trained, and he could tell.
Highly trained.
Because the chicks are fairly sexless when they're born, but he could tell right away. He said, no, that's a girl. That's a boy.
Wait, just by sight?
Well, I think he turned them over.
He had to get in there.
I think he turned them over.
He had to look under the hood.
I'm not sure because he was an old guy. And he was
be
the
good
last.
If you could just spot him.
He was, and it's S-E-X-O-R. He was the last chicken sexer.
If you grow your own chickens, it's important to know because you don't want to get a bunch of roosters. Because they're for one thing, you don't want any roosters.
You want one rooster.
Well, you want for the better eggs, you do.
Yeah.
But if you're in an area where they're charging you $150 a head and you're trying to keep your chickens
no
a secret, no roosters.
Because they crow.
You go out to Woodside where everyone has chickens.
They're crowing all the time. You can't sleep.
All day. They're
crowing. Well, it's a common misconception that roosters only crow in the morning.
They
crow all fucking day.
They do.
If you'll forgive me.
No, it's true. And they're annoying.
Wow. I didn't know that this topic brought out such a virulent
Let me
profanity.
Tell you, if you're trying to sleep in Petaluma,
don't. You're done.
And a lot of the roosters are aggressive and they're annoying. And they're jerks.
This is content.
They're all, by the way, racists.
Poor
racists.
Yes, the only.
Wait, hold on. Dial it back. Why are they racist?
Well, it's the way they are with the different chickens. But they're all rapists, too, which makes it even worse.
You meant to say rapist, but you said racist.
I did. You're right. Caught me.
Racist is interesting, though.
Well, no, but they're. Well,
you a Rhode Island Red? Oh, my God.
If Adam is listening, he knows why.
Those Rhode Island Reds are lazy.
We don't serve your kind here.
They
layabouts.
They make the lives of the poor hens miserable.
With all the raping.
Yes. Constant.
That's their job. They're not raping. They're fertilizing.
Can we talk about
Google now?
Yeah,
that's what they're doing,
Google
but
now,
a lot of the hens don't
try
like
to
it.
Tell that to the cops.
And so what's so different in life? Never mind. Let's move on.
I'm saying this is content.
So, Lauren, we did this.
Now, Lauren's given up. She's
no,
going to
no,
walk
we did this
show.
As an example.
She said, what are these idiots talking about
exactly.
chickens for? We don't care.
We don't care.
Well, I'm in New York.
I agree.
Exactly.
Are you uptown
so anyway,
or downtown, Lauren?
That's why you should move to Petaluma.
Tell us the story. You got a strange email from Google last week.
Yeah, so they
they sent me a note and they said, we can't tell you what's going on, just sign. And I was like, well, and I knew it was Google X, so it's got to be cool. And they've only announced two Google X projects, you know, the self-driving cars and the glasses. So this must have been cool. And it was this Project Loon. And it was this audacious, ambitious idea to surround the world with internet balloons. And they wanted me to come along and take some photos and just kind of see what was going on. It happened to be here in my backyard. That's totally coincidental. So I jumped in a car with my family and drove a few hours north from Queenstown up here to the Christchurch area and joined the team and started taking photos. It was a blast.
So you actually got to document this, and I know there's already one video on stuckincustoms.com. We're not looking at that right now. This is a Google video. But you shot one video, and you have another one coming in a couple of days that is in a lot of technical detail talking about what's going on here. But as soon as that video gets approved, it'll be at stuckincustoms.com. But they were smart to ask you because here you are documenting. This is the secret Google warehouse. So are these, first of all, they're in the stratosphere.
Yeah, so they're twice as high as commercial airlines, and there's basically nothing up there. There's no more weather, so they get solar power cleanly. And the big breakthrough about these balloons is that they can move up and down at various levels through the stratosphere. And as they move up and down, they can catch different air currents. So they can sort of keep this grid or matrix-like mesh sort of Cartesian plane.
They're not
going around the world.
They're not attached by a 10-mile string to the Earth.
No, they've got a valve on the bottom. It's actually a two-chamber balloon. And the top chamber is filled with helium.
Okay.
The bottom one is filled with regular air. And by pumping air in and out of the bottom chamber, they can move them up and down.
Changing the density of the helium a little bit. But that's kind of
stays the same. But they change the weight of the balloon by pumping more air into the lower chamber.
Ah, I get it.
Yeah.
So that's something you can keep doing kind of for at least until the balloon wears out.
Yeah, so that's the big goal is to not fill up the balloon too much so that it pops or that it gets yes, these holes in it. You know, they're really trying to figure out a way to keep the balloons up there for a long time. But they have had balloons get up there and stay, for months and years. I mean, ballooning is sort of an old science. It's a tough science. So they're trying to get their balloons to stay up as long as possible.
Can you show this on my screen, Chad? This is the balloon going up. So you get a sense of it. They're doing this on New Zealand as an experiment. How many balloons did they launch over New Zealand?
Dozens and dozens. I don't know the exact number. They've got this company called Raven Aerostar that they partnered with. And Raven Aerostar, they're the guys that build all these huge weather balloons for NASA. They do all kinds of crazy stuff. So these guys are super hardcore. They know what they're doing.
And how do they get the internet access to the balloon?
Well, so they have these big ground stations that are in cities or in places where they definitely have a good solid wired internet connection into the backbone. And so your signal goes up from your house, you have, or your car or your little village or whatever it is. You have this little antenna that aims up at the sky.
Here's an image, by the way, of the antenna on Trey's video. It's kind of cute. It looks like a little balloon, a little red balloon.
Yeah, and actually, you can see a little. If you look over there to the right, you can see a little white dot. That's one of the loon balloons that is flying over.
It's up here, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite tiny up in the sky.
Yeah, you can see it. So these are visible on a clear day. You can't kind of see the balloon.
That one is kind of still on its way up to the stratosphere, so they are really tough to see with the naked eye. They're pretty tiny.
Yeah, I mean, they're 10 miles away.
The signal goes up, it goes to one of the balloons, and then it gets relayed around to other balloons until it finds a ground station, goes down, gets the data, then brings it back, right to you. Yeah.
And in fact, as the balloons move over, there's a handoff, just like a cell network. And so it's an interesting technology. What kind of speed do people get?
Well, I went to a couple testers' homes, and we looked at it. It seemed perfectly broadbandish. I didn't jump on speedtest.net to see how fast it really was. But I remember the first time. So I was in there with – this is kind of a funny story. Yeah, I shouldn't tell it. But so I went into the first tester's house, and I was there with Stephen Levy from Wired Magazine, who wrote a beautiful piece over there on Wired. By the way, one of my best photos that I took is going to show up in Wired Magazine. They got an exclusive on it, so the world hasn't seen that yet.
Oh, cool.
So be sure to check out Stephen's article when it comes out in print. So anyway, what happened is we went to this tester's home, and you know, they're getting internet. They're on trademe.co.nz, which is sort of the local eBay. And then, of course, everyone in there, we want to connect and, you know, connect our cell phones or whatever and start playing with the internet. And then so Stephen Levy's over there. He's connecting to it or whatever. Then I went over and saw that, oh, people are connecting to it. I want to connect too. So I go over and I ask the Google guys, I said, what's the password I want to get on? And they said, just a minute, Mr. Levy is on the internet. I was like, all right, I'll wait till he has a good experience. And then I don't know what they thought I was going to do, you know, BitTorrent the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, but one at a time only, please.
Yeah.
How funny.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're claiming 3G speed. This is not to wire, you know, America. This is not to get cities online. This is for areas where there is no internet access.
Well, they say that there's actually quite a few Americans that don't even have good internet access.
I got a call from a guy in Montana, you know, just the other day. He says there's no internet access available to me. But these people, but if you're in the first world, you'll probably use satellite and expensive satellite internet.
I think this will be quite disruptive, the same way that fiber has been disruptive. Mm-hmm. So when fiber drops into a city, it drives competition crazy.
Right.
Suddenly people have to provide, you know, unlimited internet or drop their prices. And it's not just the access that I think is exciting. Here in New Zealand, actually, I think this is a pretty good test bed, because I've noticed this after I came from the U.S. where I'm used to having unlimited internet. But people here, they don't really have unlimited internet in their homes. And I think this is actually very common in Europe and all over the world. We're quite spoiled in the U.S. And so I know that, like, at home in Queenstown, I happen to have unlimited internet. I've got to have it, so I pay extra. But all of my son's friends who are 12 and 13, they come over and they can't believe that my son can watch unlimited YouTube videos. I mean, it's inconceivable to them.
Right.
And can you imagine being a kid growing up, not being allowed to watch, you know, maybe 10 or 20 YouTube videos a month? I mean,
it's a big deal for us as TWIP, because it means that people in New Zealand really are going to be very careful about how much of us they watch. You know, if you want to be an internet broadcaster, bandwidth caps are a bad thing.
Yeah, it sucks to make a decision like, well, do I have enough bandwidth to download Leo's show this month? You know, it's a horrible decision you have to make.
So does Google, have they said they plan to offer this for free worldwide? They probably don't know what they plan to do with it, or do they?
Yeah, they don't really have a business model for it yet. I'm sure, I don't know what the business model is for fiber. You know, I don't think they provide that for free.
They've always said that their goal as a company is to get people to use the internet more. If people use the internet more, they'll make money, because they're an internet advertising company.
Yeah, they just want to get more people on the net.
Right.
And I don't think they want to be a giant ISP and make money from, like, monthly charges.
Right.
They just want to get people internet, and then they do AdWords and this sort of thing.
Right.
That's how they make money.
It seems like they have a business model. I mean, I don't know if it's enough to pay for the infrastructure. Who knows how much these balloons cost, but the model is pretty straightforward. The more people that use the internet, the more the world is connected. It's good for the world, but it's also good for Google. And this is why, you know, no nation's going to do this, because they're floating all around the world. The UN isn't going to do this. I think it's going to be a company like the Google or the NSA. They might do it. that's a joke. Maybe not such a big joke. So this is cool. So people, if you live in New Zealand, if you go to google.com/loon, as they call it appropriately, the Loon Project, you can sign up as a tester. What do you think? I mean, this is pretty cool, Trey.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean,
it seems, you know, on the face of it, goofy.
Well, you know, this Rich Duvall is kind of one of the guys behind this. It's a huge team, of course.
Right.
But he and Mike Cassidy, they know it's an audacious plan, and they're serious. They don't want to waste their time. They want to do something that's going to work and change the world and affect a billion plus people.
Wow.
You know, these are all makers. You know, they're all like kind of Burning Man kind of guys. They love building stuff. And they, you know, they're having a ball. They're doing some serious science, and they're really iterating in a Google way. So they're, I think they've got the right approach and the right attitude. And I mean, everyone's super excited about it, especially New Zealand. Sometimes we feel like the end of the world down here. So it's exciting to get stuff to launch here.
I thought that was why you moved there. You want to be at the end of the world. So the idea, and we'll see what happens, but the idea is there's 5 billion people on the planet who are not connected to the internet right now. The vast majority, the idea is to connect as many of them as possible with hundreds, perhaps thousands of balloons floating at 60,000 feet above sea level, getting their internet access from base stations in big cities and passing along. And because it's so high, you could be in a valley. You could be really in a very remote area, surrounded by mountains, and still be able to get internet access.
Yeah. No, selfishly, I just want to put one of these little friendly red things on my truck.
Yeah.
Because I'm driving around to these remote areas of New Zealand to take photos where there's no cell phone coverage, so I have zero internet. The idea that I could just have the internet floating above me all the time, it's intoxicating.
It's awesome. Yeah. And I see you're wearing your glass. You wear it all the time?
Not in the shower.
Good.
You know, that's the
good
that's the
thinking
line that I draw.
Yes.
No, I do wear it. Actually, I find myself pulling out my cell phone very rarely.
Wow.
It's really
no more of that emasculating, girly looking at your phone stuff. You're going to wear those macho blue glasses.
Yeah, I can pull them off.
So let me get the scorecard, just so I don't offend anybody. How many of you are rooting for Edward Snowden to get away? How many think he should be hung from the neck until dead?
There's no third option.
Not according to the Justice Department. Patrick, you're a disinterested party. You're French, right? Or you just talk
funny?
Well,
I don't know. I am French,
okay.
But I don't know that I'm disinterested, because all of this story is basically, you know, you've all been discussing, is it legal? Is it not legal? Can you listen to U.S. citizens or not? Apparently, you probably shouldn't be able to do this, but no one cares about the non-U.S. citizens. So I'm very much concerned about this.
That's
about
a good
this.
Point. We've not been debating that at all. We can listen to you till the cows come
yeah,
home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's no issue there. Well, but just how do you feel about, again, you're a somewhat disinterested part in the sense that he didn't violate French law, he violated U.S. law. Is he a traitor? Is he treasonous? Or is he a whistleblower?
It's very difficult to say, isn't it, until we know exactly. I guess, ultimately, we as a society are going to decide whether or not he is a traitor and whether or not he's just a whistleblower.
We as a society may decide, but ultimately it's the U.S. Justice Department that's going to make the ultimate decision.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's what I mean by we as a society.
Right.
It's the people making laws, right?
Right.
And judging by these laws. And it obviously he revealed secrets, so that's not in question. The question is, by revealing these secrets, is he a traitor or not? What I would wish for it to happen is for him to get a fair trial. And I'm not exactly sure that's possible. But the best outcome would be for him to get a fair trial. And if he did commit treason, then he should be suffer the consequences, quote unquote. And if he exposed some serious flaws in the system, then I don't know, he should go that route.
Christina?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I'm kind of free Snowden is kind of where I'm at at this point. I mean, honestly, I mean, I kind of don't understand what's that different about him and Daniel Ellsberg with the Pentagon Papers.
Precisely.
I think that you could make the argument that Bradley Manning is a different case. You know, he was a member of the military. He, you know, revealed things that were of a more sensitive nature that weren't vetted as much. But in this case, I mean, this was a civilian who happened to have a contract job. And if what he's saying is true, then I honestly think that the public value of that information is better than outweighs the, I guess, treasonous implications that they could have.
And you could make the case that Bradley Manning endangered U.S. citizens abroad with his
absolutely
his leaks. Well, you can't make that case with Edward Snowden.
No, I mean, I think in this case, all it's really doing is the question is, does it endanger kind of the PR for the NSA and for maybe the FBI? And that really is of little concern to me. What I'm not sure about, though, I mean, I guess, is how much is what he saying that is correct and how much is maybe being inflated for his own gains. And that's not really clear yet. But I think that if it is what it seems to be, I mean, honestly, yeah, I'm free Snowden. I mean, I feel like this is why we have whistleblower laws. But to the same point, to Patrick's point, I don't think it's going to be possible for him to get a fair trial. And I mean, I think that the best thing he could hope for is that they somehow violate his looking up his mental health records or something the same way they did with Ellsberg. And that was how he ended up not being prosecuted for the Pentagon Papers.
But, right. But I think plumbers were caught breaking into a psychiatrist's office.
Right. And so, I mean, you almost have to wonder, you know, if something like that is not to happen, or if it hadn't happened in Ellsberg's case, what would that have meant for the entire narrative of what became the Vietnam War and for right. Nixon's second term and for a lot of other things? And I mean, I think that's why it's not clear to just maybe classify him as a, you know, someone who's committing treason, because what he's doing could potentially be opening up something that is vital for the public to know about, and certainly vital for us to have a discussion about what are our real reasonable expectations of privacy and what does it mean for the Fourth Amendment.
You agree, Jason?
Yes. So first, I'd like to say I always, you know, we live in a democracy, so I always don't like when we talk about it in a democracy and we say, you know, oh, it's the government's fault and that. The government is always
us
in a democracy, right? Right. They are accountable and responsible to us. So if we
unless they go so far as to not be, and that's, of course, the great fear of all of this, is that when does it go from being government of the people, by the people, for the people, to government by the governing, for the governing? And that's actually
one of the great concerns here. And I was saying I would like for him to get a fair trial, but at the same time, I'm not even sure it's possible, because even we've seen, at least we suspect, that the NSA has been lying to the different bodies that it's supposed to be answering to, or at least who are supposed to be overseeing their activities. So when it reaches that level of uncertainty, it becomes very murky. Even what you're talking about, Jason, which is we are the government. Are we really, in that case, deciding what happens when we don't even know what happens?
Right. So that's where but we do know now. And that's why I think Snowden ultimately has done something heroic. Right. He found the government doing something that it should not have been doing, and he exposed it. I mean, obviously, there's still a lot, like everyone else. I'd like to read more about the details of what really happened and what else might have been leaked or whatever. It does not appear as if he leaked anything that would cause danger to any U.S. citizens or military or intelligence. But he did catch the U.S. government doing something that they should not have done. And that's why, ultimately, I think he deserves our support and to stand up for somebody that, you know, has leaked something that we would all like to know about so that we can hold the government accountable for doing something that is sort of extra legal.
And, of course, General James Clapper, who blatantly lied to Congress when asked if the NSA collected this data, he's going to go scot-free. No contempt of Congress there. I think we owe a debt of gratitude to Edward Snowden. I don't know if he would get a fair trial in the U.S. I feel like at this point we're all just going, run, Snowden, run. And I don't know if there's anywhere you can run to in this world anymore. So I feel bad for him.
The Clapper thing, though, he was actually, as you're saying, he did blatantly lie. How come he's not suffering any kind of consequence? He lied to the Senate, right?
Yep.
And that's representatives of the people. Yep. He actually lied to the American people, yep, where he should actually, according to the law, have told the truth.
And that's, so, frankly, why that's I think there's a legitimate argument that Snowden is a whistleblower, that he is, in fact, yes, telling us something we wouldn't have known otherwise, because our own government and the director of national intelligence is lying. So the only way to find this out is to for somebody like Snowden to step forward. You know, it's a tech show, and I understand people feel like this is politics, but there is a very strong angle of technology to this, because the real question is, are electronic communications in some way less privileged than snail mail? There's nobody asserting that the NSA is going through your mail, opening your mail, there are much better protections, frankly, against that than there are against them opening your email. In fact, many courts have held, and it's the position of the federal government, that after 6 months, it's not even your email anymore. It's abandoned.
It's absolutely the stuff we should be talking about on a tech show, right?
I think
the
so.
Environment that we have created as part of a society and as technologists and people working and covering this industry have created a new set of possibilities, a new set of rules. And as a result, we have to deal with a new set of values in order to live in the society that we're shaping. So we should be talking about this. And I expect we are going to be talking even more about it over the next decade as sort of data and all of this stuff becomes more and more available and accessible. And things like this are going to happen likely again and again.
Tragedy for of another kind for photographers in Chicago. And I've been, you know, I'm really curious what you guys are going to say about this. I've been getting a lot of email and tweets about it. The Chicago Sun-Times has fired their staff reporters and 28 photographers. They fired them on Friday. And this is where it gets weird. Apparently, the reporters for the writing reporters, the written reporters for the newspaper are going to be trained in iPhonography. They're apparently expected to pick up the slack and take pictures with their cameras.
Sign of the times.
Well, that's what, you know, this is what intrigued me about this, that so many people were up in arms about this. And I, of course, when people get fired, it's terrible. But this is a measure of the fact that newspapers are just dying.
Well, you know,
I don't hear that when 28 reporters get fired.
It's interesting because there's a parallel in television news, especially local news, where a lot of camera guys, a lot of studio guys got axed as soon as they started automating the studios with robot. If you've never seen robot cameras where you can remote.
They're scary because they are fast and they're heavy. Oh, yeah. And if you get in the way, you can get clobbered.
And, you know, one of the things, if you know, especially if you're in the business and you're applying for a job, you'll notice that a lot of the listings say they want a predator, which is essentially a producer that can edit as well as write and do all the other story, all the other stuff that used to be covered by two other individuals. So in a way, it's just a cost saving measure, whether or not you'll get the same level of quality.
Not from an iPhone. I can pretty much guarantee you. But I agree with you. I thought this was very interesting because when reporters are laid off, 100 reporters are laid off when Rupert Murdoch's Daily went under. Nobody goes, oh my God, this is horrible. Look what's happening to newspapers.
Reporters do, but I don't think actual normal people do.
But the internet community got very up in arms about the photographers getting fired. I saw Trey Ratcliffe and others writing about this, very upset.
Well, you want both. You want both pros using great equipment. But if you are a journalist today, you should be taking photos as well. You should be shooting video. You should be doing all kinds of stuff. You can't just be a word person.
Dave McDean, our chat room, informs me the Metropolitan Opera fired their entire ballet company this week. Not one word in the press. But I think it's because we identify with photographers. Photographers are kind of the new heroes of the geek of new media, right?
Are they?
And so these 28 guys, by the way, of all the people who could possibly be fired at a newspaper, the photographers are the most likely to find work immediately, right?
Oh, yeah. You would switch topics. You wouldn't be shooting a news story. Shoot a wedding or a birthday party.
But there's got to be work for you.
Well, you know,
not a lot of work for a compositor.
Well, that's the thing is like even some of these photographers probably have some editing, compositing, you know, post-production skills on photos because you cannot survive, especially in today's environment, on just being good at one particular aspect of your job. You want to be able to maybe not be incredibly good at everything, but at least competent because you don't want to be in a position where the company's looking to save a few dollars and looking at some, well, you know, can you edit? I mean, you're a great anchor person, but can you edit too? Because it'd save us a lot of money and, you know, or we'll hire the new guy who comes at half the rate.
Chris Marquardt. Yeah, go ahead.
This is the business that we're in, right? I mean, this is what Twit does. This is what new media does. We have figured out that the work, the production work that used to take millions of dollars and a huge studio to do, we can now do not on the cheap, but for, you know, with a much different type of crew, different type of equipment. The same thing happens to photography. The newspapers have realized camera phones or, you know, prosumer cameras have become so good and amateur photographers get so many different angles that they can essentially get the same coverage. They can get the same material, the same content that they need at a much lower price. So in essence, if you're going to be blaming the newspaper, you should be blaming content creators like us and amateur content creators.
And Craigslist.
Change the game.
You would just completely undermine the entire financial structure.
You would essentially be blaming everyone that has a piece of technology that allows them to capture a still image, a moving image, and recording audio. I mean, think about the last three big news stories where most of the content came from people not associated with the press. I mean, the soldier in London that was hacked to death, a lot of those videos.
There were iPhone videos.
iPhone videos. Yeah. The Boston bombing, those were all captured either by CCTVs or
photojournalists are important, arguably the most important form of journalism today, since we are in a much... Vince Lefore, who is a great photographer, wrote a blog post, How to Ensure Your Extinction. Look at what newspapers are doing. And he says, you know, he's talking about we're in the heyday of photography. He says, well, sarcastically, obviously, teenagers are clearly reading 300 to 1,200 word articles on newspaper websites on a regular basis. They're not. They're looking at pictures, right? And you look at what the Boston Globe does with the big picture, which is wonderful. Clearly, they're making money on their photojournalists. So maybe really the short-sightedness was that the Chicago Sun-Times couldn't figure out a way to make these guys pay.
I'm kind of astounded they had 28.
28? That's a lot. Unbelievable.
To go from what sounds like a pretty plush photography staff to nothing, it must be kind of jarring. And I am kind of curious what their front page will look like.
If it's iPhone photos.
If it's iPhone photos.
It's a lot of Instagram.
Non-professionals.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, Leo, you know this. You don't necessarily want to cut out, you know, try to bridge everything with one person, but you want to pick and choose where you have that one or two individuals that are really good at photography and send them out on that story. And everything else, like, oh, yeah, you're covering, you know, the latest, you know, city council, you know, debate on, you know, whether or not a new park needs a tree or something. You can send someone with an iPhone and cover that. But if it's something that, you know, is going to make the front page or something that's incredibly timely, yeah, you want to send out the best person for that job.
Vince is arguing they should have fired more reporters and kept the photographers. He might have a point there. The photographers in this day and age might be more important. But I think, you know, Leo, go ahead.
Can I ask a question? And that is there still the room for the pure photographer? I mean, is it now? No, you have to be a media creator. You have to be a content creator. You can't just do photography. You need to do videography. You need to do editing. Like Roger said, you have to have the talent along the entire spectrum. You can't any longer just be the guy with the great eye. You have to be able to deliver on many different levels in the new media world, right? I mean,
that's a good point. In fact, you might have hit the nail on the head. The guy who did this, Tim Knight, was the publisher at Newsday when they did exactly the same thing. In 2008, they fired 20 people from their staff, but they allowed them, and this may happen at the Chicago Sun-Times, to reapply for multimedia jobs. So they allowed them to say, okay, you know, we're not – still photos are – look at all the attention the New York Times got for that the avalanche piece that they did. It was a multimedia piece. It wasn't just stills. It was video. It was moving. Clearly, newspapers are maybe looking more to the web and more to being multimedia producers. So maybe that's what's going on. So I don't think anybody in their right mind would say we are in a less visual age. What is Time? Does Time Magazine have staff?
We have both.
A lot of freelancers.
A lot of it's
right?
done by freelance. I mean, we have astounding photography done by people who've done it for decades and have won all kinds of awards. But when I went to the D conference last week, I was taking photos and putting them up too. So they're not mutually exclusive. You want to have the best possible photographers doing work with the best possible equipment, and people just sort of telling the story with whatever they have at hand at the moment.
Good news, Andy Yannacco still at the Chicago Sun-Times and a master of iPhonography, I might add. You're watching our Best Of episode. Kevin Rose is coming out in just a bit. Not coming out. That's different. He's coming up in just a minute. Kevin Rose versus Raccoon. Who will win in this grudge match? Yes, it's URC. Get it? Universal Raccoon Championships. But first, terrible joke. First, a word from Audible.com. Boy, if you had to say who was the sponsor that typified Twit all year and for the last 4 or 5 years, it has to be Audible.com. Everyone who works on Twit loves Audible. We're all Audible fans because, well, frankly, if you've got a commute, if you
spend any time at the gym. If there are times when you would like to be reading a book but you can't because you can't hold one, Audible is a lifesaver. I first discovered Audible at the turn of the century, yeah, literally 13 years ago when I was commuting from Tech TV. Long commute would have made me nuts if I hadn't been able to listen to great audiobooks. Now, 500 books later, I've got an amazing library of books. By the way, I can see all of those books on my iPad app, my iPhone app, the Android app, the Windows Phone, the Windows 8 app. I can browse through my previous reads. To be honest, some of the books I've purchased from Audible.com over the years, I haven't ever gotten around to reading, but they're still there. They're still in my library. I can read them anytime. It's really nice to have a bookshelf of great audiobooks. And when I say great, I mean great. Audible is the best readers, the best books. All the major bestsellers come out at Audible.com, right day and date. Before I go see a movie like The Hobbit, I like to listen to a book. I like to hear it first, and Audible's great for doing that. It makes a movie in your mind. That's what I love about Audible. Now, here we've got a special deal for you. If you visit audible.com/twit2, you can get two books free. All right? You're going to be signing up for the Platinum account. That's the account I use. Two books a month. But your first month is free. Your first two book credits are free. You can cancel anytime in that first 30 days. You'll owe nothing. Remember Andy Anako's pick last week or a week ago? He loved the Patrick Stewart reading the Christmas Carol. That could be one. You might want to listen to some history or a classic. The Great Gatsby on Audible is fantastic. I loved listening to this. Jake Gyllenhaal narrates it. Does such a good job. You can get that for free. Pick two books. That's the hard part. Then go to audible.com/twit2 and sign up today. I know you're going to love Audible. A great selection of wonderful books are waiting for you. audible.com/twit2. And we really do thank Audible for all these years for making Twit possible. One of our really most valued sponsors. We love them all. But Audible's been here since almost the beginning. Thank you, Audible. Audible.com/twit2. If you haven't joined, this is your chance. We continue on with our best of this week in tech. When I first started the company, Twit, in 2005, I asked my two friends from Tech TV, Patrick Norton and Kevin Rose, to partner with me. Understandably, they perhaps were not sure that Twit was going to be a going concern. Kevin had this thing called Dig. I guess he thought that was going somewhere. I don't know. Patrick Norton had just started doing Techzilla. He thought it was better to have a regular paycheck from Revision 3. I guess they did all right. But I've always had a soft spot in my heart for those guys and all the people I worked with at Tech TV. I remember when Kevin came in, this was episode 415, so what this is about a couple of 3 months ago. And it was just perfect timing to get him on the show because the night before, he had come upon a raccoon attacking his dog Toaster. His video went viral. Let's take a look. Somebody we haven't seen in a long time, but who has gained some notoriety this week.
Yeah.
Mr. Kevin Rose.
Hello, hello.
Of Google Ventures.
I don't know if I wanted to have this notoriety.
Our timing couldn't have been better. We booked you before.
Yeah, like 4 weeks ago or something like that.
So don't think that we're capitalizing on the incident.
And don't think that Leo put that raccoon there.
Yeah, exactly.
Part of a harassment policy.
He planted that.
So almost 1 million views now on the YouTube video that you posted just, what, yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday.
Yeah, it's going to pass up my Barney for sure.
I would show this video, but I'm afraid of getting, when we show YouTube videos, sometimes we get pulled down. So we thought we'd reenact it, right? Can we do a reenactment?
We have a raccoon in the house. Anyone, please.
There's a stairwell. Wait a minute. I'm just going to show you what Kevin did. I have to get up to do this.
This is amazing. I had no idea this was happening.
Is my dog at the bottom of the stairs? All right. Okay. So we're gonna reenact.
So Leo has left the studio. To take on Leo. That would be amazing.
He's going down.
I would love it if the raccoon came and did an interview with you, like all tense and.
There is a Twitter account for the raccoon now, apparently.
Right. Okay. Of course there is.
Oh! It looks like. There we go.
Did you scream like a girl when you did
I didn't
it?
Scream like that, no. Okay. It's a Leo original there.
It's okay. There's no record.
He could just show
Ladies and gentlemen, that's show business. This would make great radio.
Yeah. And now he's locked out of the studio.
He's locked out.
He locked himself out.
The show just got
Kevin, you're going to be the host today.
This had been planned for about 15 minutes.
Did we introduce Jolie yet? Oh, no, here he comes.
There we go.
Exhausting. Why can't you show videos on the show?
No, I can't.
I was going to say.
Unfortunately, my dog was here. We should have borrowed yours.
What did you throw down the stairs?
That was a raccoon. Bring me the raccoon.
He keeps a dead raccoon in the place.
So, what happened? You let Toaster out?
Yeah, I mean, so we had gone out for dinner.
Well, let's start at the beginning.
Yeah.
Why did you name the dog Toaster?
Have you not seen Battlestar Galactica?
Are you kidding me? Oh, he named it after the Instagram filter.
No, you're talking about the second hit of Cylon.
Toasters are the evil, like...
Oh, you're talking about the
Cylons
name for Cylon.
Toasters.
Oh, see, the second iteration of the show, I hated it. I watched one episode and I wrote
a
nasty...
Does light go up and down his spine?
No, he does not have that.
I had no idea you named Toaster after Cylon.
Yeah, Daria came up with the name and...
That's hysterical.
We thought it was awesome. Yeah, he looks like burnt toast when you
It's much more cuddly than a Cylon. He's like a little cute little cuddly curly dog.
Did he get bit?
Yeah.
So you let him...
He got hit
look at,
hard,
wait a minute, pause
yeah.
that there.
Well, he's the one...
Pause that there. Go back here. So you let him out of the house to pee.
Yeah, it's like 1 a.m. We're getting ready to go to bed. You know, we got home from a late dinner.
Pause it.
And, you know, you let the dog out, and he always barks a couple times when he goes down because it's like he's kind of scared. Well, we've had raccoons in the house before.
No, Ozzy does that too. He's kind of clearing the way.
Clearing the way.
Yeah.
And so I hear a couple barks, and then I hear that kind of like... yeah, like... Exactly. Pretty much. It was just chaos. It was like clearly something went wrong.
Scrabble, scrabble, scrabble.
And he's yelping at that point. Like he's like really getting hurt.
So show the video. So daddy to the rescue because you just...
Well, I ran down the stairs because I was like, what the hell's going on? And
then
I see a raccoon there.
But now wait, pause it again. Normal reaction at this point is to get a stick, a bag.
Or start kicking.
No, that's adrenaline. That's hurting his puppy
dog. Well, at this point, if you look back at the video, at the very end there, he had actually flipped over and he was on top of Toaster.
And Toaster was on his back.
And he was clawing at his eyes and like trying to like basically kill him.
Fight or flight here.
Yeah,
you decided to fight. I would have run.
Worst case, the thing's going to, like, bite you or claw at you.
Wow, that could be a bad case.
I mean, it's going to hurt, but you know that you're strong enough to, like, you know, deal with the animal.
Show the rest of it. I'm sure you've got complaints from PETA already because he actually picks up... Oh, my God! Wait a minute. Pause it again.
Well, there's a better camera view.
You picked it up.
Yeah, so I grabbed it by its back and just picked it up and pulled it off of Toaster.
Are you watching the show?
No, I'm trying to get...
Are you not entertained?
I'm trying to get into the chat room, but I can't figure out how to turn the volume down on this crazy thing.
It's his old tiny laptop. It lags a little.
We're going to wait while John watches what just happened.
Let's see here. There's a thing. There we go.
It's almost like being on Skype, isn't it, John?
Yeah. Now he just wants to be with you, Joy.
That's what I do usually. It usually doesn't have the sound turned up to the max.
That's true. There are other ways. We'll help you get in the chat room next time. Anyway, so was it heavy?
It was about 25 pounds or so, and it felt very...
You've been lifting. You're in good shape.
I'm in good shape. It felt very greasy and
it's
oily.
It's not that heavy.
And kind of like...
yeah, he's got a bunch of garbage and snot.
Yeah, no, raccoons are clean. They wash their food before they eat it.
Yeah.
With pee.
So continue with the video.
So
this is a... Wait a minute. Pause it. This is a security camera.
Yeah, we have cameras around the house, obviously, to like guard against weird things. And
so this is good. You recorded your own hard drive, so you had access to the
video. No. It just goes to the cloud instantly.
Oh. And so it's like Dropcam or something.
Yeah, it's similar to that.
Okay. All right. So finish the video.
Yeah, it's motion
because the other angle
activated.
Is good.
The other and then I have another camera that gets the other angle. So there, it flung it.
Yeah, but and what I love is that you then go after it.
Well, I mean,
and we don't know how this movie ends because
you cut it short. Yeah,
but let's
I'll
just watch. You. This is the best angle.
This is the other angle,
which has inspired an animated GIF. Holy cow!
What flew off the raccoon?
I think it was Toaster's fur. It was Toaster's fur that he had.
We actually had a debate on the radio show about that. I thought it was its eyeball.
It was two eyeballs at the bottom.
It was Toaster's fur, I think, we've decided.
Sad.
And now, of course, they've made an animated GIF of you.
I'm throwing thousands of raccoons at this point.
It's like a raccoon conveyor belt.
Yeah, it's basically what it is, one after another. So this is how I get my workout in. It's really good for the triceps. It's like
Okay, so what no one knows is what happened after you went.
So I went down there. It flipped back over because it landed on its back, and then it just ran out the fence. There's a fence there, and it like got between the bars and took off.
It was still alive.
Oh, I mean, actually, I went out to see if like I'd injured it, but it had just taken off.
Did it go?
it just took off really fast. So
did
it was
they
only
communicate.
There was three of them actually. So that's one thing you don't know is I saw two others down there. So
yeah,
it was total three of them.
Moves in.
Now, you have to wonder, why would a raccoon go after a dog? Usually they're after garbage or raccoon stuff.
So here's the thing that's interesting. I don't know if it was this raccoon, but there was another raccoon in the neighborhood that took out another dog's eye like a couple weeks before. So these things are getting pretty aggressive in our neighborhood.
Wow.
So it's crazy.
That sucks.
And so why did you post this?
Well,
video?
Here's the thing. I didn't even remember that we had the cameras. I was so on adrenaline
and
everything else.
I bet you
didn't
sleep that
night. Yeah, and Toaster's like growling the entire night. And it's like 2 a.m. and I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm like, we're laying in bed and I pull it up on my phone because my phone has access to the camera data. And I was like, holy shit. And then
this is really good.
Dario was like, what are you talking about?
This is really
good.
And I go,
look at this. And I showed her the video and it just has to go on the internet.
Now, Dario, did you try to talk him out of this? Did you say, don't, Kevin, you're crazy. Don't post this. You said put it on YouTube immediately.
Yeah, of course. It's awesome.
So you're not getting heat from like animal rights activists?
Yeah.
Well,
here's the deal. Here's the way that I would phrase it to anyone. I'm not out to hurt animals, obviously. There's one of two ways I could throw that raccoon: up the stairs or down the stairs. If I throw it up the stairs, it's going like back into my house. So I had to get rid of it. I wasn't going like,
to
shoo it away.
Right.
And so, you know, it was just it happened to spin and look back in the camera in an awkward way. And it's just like, I'm not like actively trying to like kill raccoons.
You would have done the same thing, Jolie.
I would have done that and worse. If anybody came after my little puppy poo, I don't care. I mean, I'd go into mama bear mode.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is weird how you flip into that mode. Like, I don't have kids, but I got into that mode where I was like, this is my, like, little baby dog. Like, don't.
Yeah.
I thought
no,
it was
you
killing
did everything
it.
But pound your chest afterwards.
Right.
More of the Snowden leaks are coming out. And now this most recent story is essentially that the National Security Agency has done a huge amount to bypass privacy on the web. To undermine encryption, they dedicate, according to the story, as much as $250 million a year of their secret budget to subverting companies like Microsoft. They literally are planting agents within these companies to put backdoors in their encryption. They've subverted the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which is a standards body in the United States that, among other things, protect, you know, create standards for government encryption. It seems as if we've got an out of control surveillance state. What is your, you know, you're not an American, Renee.
Yep.
You're in Montreal. From outside of the U.S., what is your take? What do you see going on here? And my real concern, and I think this is Bruce Schneier and others have raised this. My real concern is that the United States is in effect undermining the basis of the internet, and it's making United States products. If you're not worried about privacy, it means that no nation outside the United States should even consider a United States product. The U.S. government told us last year, don't buy phones from Huawei and ZTE because they're made by the Chinese government, in effect, and they're spying on us. Well, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah. It's interesting to me because exactly what you say, there are a lot of states in which you live under the presumption of surveillance. A lot of people in England say their laws are written in such a way that this is perfectly legal and they don't understand the outcry in North America. We have CSIS in Canada, and I believe part of their purview is domestic surveillance. So there's a lot of countries where you can barely do anything without the oversight of the government. But the difference in the United States is that theoretically this should not be possible. And if agencies want to do this, they should go and pass the prerequisite laws required to make this legal and allow people to, or the Congress and the Senate, to vote on those laws. And if it's not legal, they shouldn't be allowed to do it. I mean, they should have to go and make their case in a free society to a republic society and make it legal and then go ahead and do it. But what it does is exactly what you said about China. You can't have confidence in buying a Chinese device because you found spyware on the photography frame that you
bought at the local Costco or whatever it is. And the same thing now is true. I believe that it's so badly broken that I'm just never going to trust any technology company or any technology product ever again, because it's the kind of trust that once broken, you can never get back. If they can lie about spying now, there's no point in them saying we've stopped doing it, because you'll never believe them. And it undermines not only the internet, it undermines your faith in any product you use on any service ever for the rest of time.
Bruce says it undermines the very fabric of the internet. It is doing huge damage. Now, Gibson came on and said, look, a lot of this is essentially link bait from these news agencies. He says, understand what's happening here. And Schneier says this too, the math is still good. Strong encryption has not been cracked. There's no reason to think that the NSA has such supercomputer powers in the basement there that they're able to get through, you know, 2048 or much less 4096-bit, RSA encryption. Strong encryption still works. But the NSA realized before 9/11 and stepped it up after 9/11 that the internet was rapidly going dark for them. And so has created an effort in which they spend $250 million a year, at least, to get around this. And so they talk about a very commonly used telecom program that the NSA placed a backdoor in. I'm presuming it's Skype. You have to presume that any closed source encryption like Microsoft's BitLocker or Apple's File Vault could very well have a backdoor in it. But Steve pointed out, and this is absolutely true, if you're using TrueCrypt or OpenPGP, if you're using an open source solution, you're likely still able to send secure messaging. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I think much of what's happening here is confusing, and it can be perceived as clickbait. But this is an incredibly James Bamford, who you can find his books on Audible, is a security researcher who's come to many of the same conclusions that you have on security now, and that is, what's happened here is far more than simple failings of technology or the ability of technology. What's very scary about this is policy decisions that led to infiltrations within the technology industry in the late 90s and early 2000s. It is not simply, it's difficult to articulate how important this is without seeming hyperbolic and clickbaity yourself. But this is an incredibly important story, not just because of the technology components, but because of the duplicity involved and the secrecy involved in infiltrating on a human level the entire industry.
From ProPublica, cryptographers have long suspected that the NSA planted vulnerabilities in a standard adopted in 2006 by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the U.S. Encryption Standards Body, and later by IOS, which has 163 countries as members. Classified NSA memos appear to confirm that the fatal weakness discovered by Microsoft cryptographers, by the way, in 2007, was engineered by the agency. They're actually subverting NIST. The NSA wrote the standard and aggressively pushed it on the international group, privately calling the effort in these memos, quote, a challenge in finesse. They created the standard.
There's two scary things about this is not only that they created backdoors, there's no guarantee that other people haven't found them and used them. I mean, just because the NSA is using them doesn't mean people that you'd be much more worried about than the NSA aren't using them. And also they store the stuff. So while the strong encryption is good now, who knows how good it'll be in 5 years with the advance of the computers or 10 years. Yep. But I do think that it's nice in America, at least, that there's a debate about this stuff going on, because in a lot of countries, it's just assumed or your government is legally allowed to do this thing and there's no dialogue going on about it, or people are just not aware of it. About it. And at least here, and I don't know if it's clickbait or not, the level of awareness to a culture that usually doesn't care about anything because privacy is, they'd rather have convenience than privacy. I'm really glad the debate at least is going on.
I want to close out the show, but first, Chad's got to push this button that's going to show you what you missed if you haven't been watching Twit all this week.
Previously on Twit, Gizwiz.
This is called the Squatty Potty. How's it going back there?
Not so good.
I'd just like you to test this out here. How's it going for you in there now?
OMG Craft.
Icicle. Bye, bicycle. Test. Testing 1, 2, 3.
This week in YouTube.
Oh,
wait, what?
Day you buy.
Get out of my camera.
Sorry.
Are you taking my
stuff? It has a screen on the back, but it doesn't allow you to
see what's on your own thing. Like, wait a minute. Wait a second. While I'm taking a selfie.
You're such a ham.
All about Android.
Chad, what's up?
Hey, every nothing.
iPad today.
And ways to grow. Reading Rainbow.
OMG Twit. You heard me.
Rainbow. A reading rainbow.
I had no idea that was a parody to play.
We've just been Chad rolled.
That big thanks to Anthony, who edited that, and then I didn't watch it before the show.
That was brilliant. That was brilliant.
Fantastic.
OMG Twit.
What is Silk Road? You probably know.
I read things.
Because you're black?
No, because I'm super smart and hang out on the internet.
It's where I get my ecstasy.
He gestured to the right, and I honestly didn't know whether it was me or Baratunde he was pointing to, and that made me extraordinarily
happy. I actually thought it was Schwood because he's
my intent.
Libertarian.
So it actually isn't a website. It's a dark website. They use Tor to protect it. You have to kind of use Tor to get to it.
Got to know somebody to get in the club.
You got to know somebody to get in the club. Yeah. But apparently, and I've never been there, you can use Bitcoin to buy drugs on Silk Road.
What?
It was one of the most popular Bitcoin using sites, right? Because it's completely anonymous, theoretically.
Which nothing really is. We found out.
The FBI, in a very interesting sting, they actually did some legwork and found the guy by going through old postings and tying it back to a Gmail account. They say it's the guy anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
he says he's not.
Their claims about how they uncovered this person are a real good lesson for anybody who's actually trying to hide.
Yeah.
Which, because it shows you how hard it actually is. I mean, they've gone back nearly three years in online statements, transaction forum postings, blog posts, and found little mistakes, hints of how someone's interested in the Mises Institute. Like,
right. It was really an interesting
hard
story,
to,
wasn't it?
To not be yourself
I can
is
see
what
the
I
movie.
Got from that story, assuming it's true. It's
well,
like you're going to let pieces of your personality slip out.
Exactly.
You're
going to
drop hints with that revelation. And somebody's going to come knocking at your door.
Even if you use, handles.
Yeah.
At some point. So whoever this guy is. And I'm just going to tell it. Look, I understand Olbricht is accused. It's alleged. There's no,
Yeah,
we don't
it makes
know.
Nothing but sense. The guy made millions and millions of dollars. He lived in some crappy place in San Francisco
they
with
didn't
two
even
roommates.
Know his name. His roommate said, well, we called him Josh.
I'm just not buying this story at all.
You think that, that's interesting.
But regardless, like even if it's not the guy, it doesn't matter. Like we're
they
all
claim
just exploring
the
intellectual possibility.
Right,
here.
Right. They claim he's the Dread Pirate Roberts. That's the handle DPR.
Great name.
That the guy who ran Silk Road used. What's interesting is the FBI says they have recovered his wallet.
That's
probably,
very nice
probably,
of them.
Probably on his computer.
You found your wallet,
in his wallet.
Sir.
And this would be also incriminating, I think, 144,000 bitcoins. I have 4 in my wallet. So they're worth more than $100 each.
How did they do this? It's a virtual product.
No, but your wallet is stored on a computer hard drive.
Okay.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is Bitcoin is not a cloud-based product, as I understand it, insofar as, like, there's not a central server. It's not like Napster. It's more like BitTorrent, where it's like you keep the keys to your own money separate from everything
right.
else. And if they recover your keys, they essentially have your money.
That's right. In fact, people have had their Bitcoins stolen by
so this is when you want to get hacked by a crypto locker.
So he, in other words, the way it sounds, either had the computer on him so they could associate it with him, that it had all the bitcoins
on
there.
Probably that's the case.
And he kept an unencrypted file, unencrypted system that would allow them to just waltz right in and find the wallet. That's what you're telling me.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not buying any of it.
They had the FBI official. This is from an article in Forbes by Andy Greenberg. The FBI official, he says, pointed me towards this Bitcoin address, and he gives a link to the Bitcoin address, which, according to the public Bitcoin transaction network, the blockchain, had received 144,000 transactions in the last 24 hours. Something's going on.
Yeah. All right. So I think what I'm about to say might feel like a side jag, but I feel like it's totally in line with what we're talking about right here. What we're talking about is the ethics of behavior, about the ability to look at a history of a person's transactions and figure out if he's guilty or innocent or whatever. Here's what's remarkable to me, and I kind of want to throw this out there, and if you guys don't want to go along, that's fine. We'll move on to something else. But is the nature of internet transactions causing all of us to be more ethical? And what I mean by that is, you know, for the entire history of mankind, there has been some religion or other that has said there is a permanent record and there is an entity monitoring your every move. And, are you doing the right thing or the wrong thing?
That's the theory of Bitcoin. You know, cash is anonymous. That's why a lot of people like John C. Dvorak don't want cash to ever be eliminated, because it's the only really anonymous way to pay for
it. How he buys his drugs.
Right.
Right.
But not just drugs.
I'm old enough, I don't need drugs.
No, but whatever. You know, if you don't want the government to monitor you, you can't use a credit card. You can't write a check. You have to use cash. And you have to get it from some anonymous source.
My middle initial is C.
So, Brian, where are you going?
Well, okay, where I'm headed with this is that it's not just about Bitcoin. Bitcoin is just one of the different threads in this discussion. You know, there's technology now. You can actually go online to YouTube and look at where they have recorded movies. You know, there's movies of people doing this thing or acting or doing whatever they do. And there are people who have figured out that you can look at the difference in the color scheme of their skin and amplify it and be able to see the rate of their pulse as they're acting in the movie. You see a baby and it looks like he's flashing red, but that's just because they turn up the contrast to a billion on this thing.
Or that baby's the devil.
Or it could be. But also there's the ability to break down. There's the ability to break down the patterns.
What are you doing?
I'm having trouble listening to this.
What are you talking about? My point is, we exist as a series of patterns. Whether it's what we write, whether it's
get to the point. What are you saying there, Schwood? What are you saying?
What are you trying to tell us, man, dude?
My question is the, and by the way, first dude of the entire show came from you, bro.
Thank you.
What? Here's what I'm trying to say: is do we exist in a age where essentially we're all naked? Who we are on the inside is transparent to anyone who has the right algorithm that can break it down, whether it's your spending habits.
No, and that's what's interesting about this. In order to be able to tie this to somebody, and even to get to the Bitcoins, you have to have the secret. It's using public key crypto. So you have to have, in effect, the secret key, which means they must have seized his hardware and it wasn't encrypted, or they got him to unencrypt it. That gives you the connection, right, to his physical hard drive. But otherwise, no, you, without somebody's secret key, you don't know who. If I, you know, I get Bitcoin donations because we have a little donate thing on the twit.tv. I don't know where those came from. I have no idea. It's a long
number.
But
you don't care either.
I don't want to know.
Well, I don't know why.
It's anonymous.
See, I don't think so. I suspect strongly that we exist as a series of patterns. And we all do this, whether it's in the way we relate to other people.
Fishwood.
We tend I'm telling to use, you.
What did he take?
He's high.
I hear you. I really do. What I'm thinking
you don't.
No, I do.
Okay.
So I think what he's getting at is, like, look, we have...
We're screwed is what he's saying. We're doomed.
What I'm hearing is we perform a lot, but the nature of who we actually are is available to anyone who sees the full extent of everything we do.
They can see through the mask.
Exactly.
To the true person.
They can see I'm sorry.
And where do they see that? How do they see that?
Through every digital/virtual interface.
The metadata. It's in the metadata.
So
I just...
Personal metadata.
And Leo brings up a good point because this is the reason this is exceptional is because it never existed before. We never logged every move we ever made. Right. Before our lifetimes.
I love your move, Schwood.
He's sounding so much like Dennis Hopper right now.
Hey, generation man. In history.
Oh, man.
The patterns of your life are stored on drives, man. They're on drives.
It helps and that he's not in the room.
Look. Oh, yeah.
I know, because he'll kill me right now.
Let me tell you some facts.
We're going to facts.
Man, facts. Incoming.
Tell me if you disagree with any of this. We live in an age where somebody can look at your history of tweets, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 tweets, and manufacture a tweet that will pass the Turing test of looking like it comes from you.
That's correct.
True or false?
True.
Right. So in that regard,
episode of Black Mirror.
Really? Is it? Wow. All right. Yeah. So like in that regard, we exist as a pattern that can be replicated. In that regard, we are.
I'm counting on
hey,
that.
Hey, because... copying a tweet is not the same as being replicated.
No,
you're taking a huge leap of faith with
that's
that
true.
One.
And no, that's true.
Schwood, if I could.
Yes.
Poet didn't know it.
But you're
here is the, and I would love to bring it back to the last of our tech stories because I have a feeling we might be losing some people. But it's always fun.
Oh yeah, no, they're all gone already. Their audience has left.
But it's not about the audience anymore. This is about us now.
It's always about us. It's been about us.
So
since
here we
the
go, show.
Ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to Twit Late Night.
This is like Twit Philosophy Hour.
Yeah.
The trick with the limitation on your theory, Schwood, is that not all of our self is expressed in digital form. So if you have a pie chart which represents all of us, what percentage of us is actually...
I think I understand what you're saying.
I have thoughts that never touch a machine.
No, I understand that, but right? I think what you're saying, Brian, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you have enough data points in the mix, you can triangulate somebody's total persona
at some point.
And I'm saying I don't know what that number is, but the word total
is premature.
Do you not think that you leak stuff into the things you say?
Leak does not represent the full volume behind the leak.
So you think there's something hidden that even if I had all of your data,
this got to do with the Bitcoin guy getting busted? That's what I'd like to know.
Because he got busted based on being himself online.
Hold on, we're solving the problems of the universe.
He made some...
No, no, there's a direct link.
We don't even know it's the same guy, so I'm not buying any of this.
Well, in that case, then nothing is nothing.
Well, that's always true.
And there's a great song.
So nothing what's interesting is that an FBI spokesman says that they will likely exchange the seized bitcoins for dollars after the trial concludes.
Sure they will.
And they can upgrade healthcare.
Of course, they've shut down Mt. Gox, so I don't know where they plan to do that. But anyway.
All right.
They have to put Mt. Gox back online so they can get their money.
That's
going to work.
It is a very interesting world the FBI has dealt
with. Future's
now,
weird, y'all.
If you heard my interview on Wednesday, we had the guy who founded LavaBit, the email system that Edward Snowden used, Ladar Levinson, was on Triangulation on Wednesday.
Okay.
And talked about how the FBI approached him. And his sense was that the FBI had no clue what they were up to or what they were looking for.
Mm.
And yet this is fairly sophisticated FBI work. I mean, this is pretty deep work. I wonder where the truth lies. Are there experts within the FBI that can do that kind of triangulation that you're talking about, Brian?
Well, I think Brian should be hired.
Could you do it?
By the way, for the record, I apologize if I took us into deep philosophical territory.
No, I love it.
It's like I'm fascinated by
this idea, though.
No, I think that's a very interesting premise.
Yeah, it is.
What is that critical amount of data that you can get about somebody that you can know everything about that?
And so
that you can reach within to that.
I was very,
or at least predict with a certain level of accuracy what they're going to do next.
Turing test is the key, that it's indistinguishable from an actual person, whether we are really in fact
one tweet won't do it. I can tell you
right now.
No,
it's not a tweet.
No.
But don't you think there's a certain amount of data, whatever that amount is, at which point.
This is a statistically significant.
All you guys are crazy. Okay,
we're going to reach that, but that's a new kind of singularity that I think.
Here we go.
No, I think we're going to reach that, and I think we're going to reach that in the next decade.
Oh my God,
Black Mirror.
No, absolutely. Think about this. There is somebody born. I think Leo's 100% right on this. There's somebody who's born.
Get Kurzweil on the show.
Who will be so good at recording their track record and use certain words and certain types of jokes and certain positions that you will be able to predict with a degree of accuracy so high that it will be indistinguishable from the guy's actual tweets when he was alive. I believe this. I'm hoping this
happens before I die so that we can keep Twit going.
Yeah.
Because we'll have a 3D
there you
simulacrum.
Go. Yeah, you can
no,
have a,
I'm gonna go
you'd
this
have
far,
a
Leo. I'm
fake everybody.
Bet.
We're going to be talking to dead people.
Hold on. Wait. Get ready. We're on episode 429 of Twit.
Yeah.
I would bet right now that somebody could manufacture a fake episode of Twit out of entirely our previous things.
Yeah, if it was an episode like this, that's for sure.
Well, it might not make sense. You're right. But it would be to all appearances
a real
version of Twit. That takes us almost up to the present. That was just a couple of months ago. We were talking about Bitcoin and Silk Road and Ross Ulbricht. Boy, I hope you've enjoyed this best of. It just reminds me how many great people come on Twit week in, week out. There's the regulars like John C. Dvorak and Mike Elgin, and just so many other people who have joined us. I really look forward every Sunday to doing TWIT because I learn so much. I hope you learn and enjoy TWIT too. We really thank the guy who puts this show together, put this best of together as well, Chad Johnson. He does a great job every week of putting together a panel, getting together all the news stories to talk about, wrangling everybody. We couldn't do it without you, Chad. We couldn't do it without you, the viewers, without our fabulous sponsors. TWIT was the first show that launched this network. And I'm really, I have to say, now here we are 8 years in, and I still look forward to it every Sunday afternoon. 3 p.m. Sunday afternoon Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 3 plus 12 equals 15 plus 8 equals 2300 UTC. I know it's a little late, but think of it as your Sunday evening entertainment. Of course, if you can't be here live, you can always download on-demand audio or video after the fact. We have a variety of different formats available to you at twit.tv or wherever podcasts are. And I don't think there's a podcatcher alive that doesn't get TWIT. To this day, one of the number one podcasts in the world, and we owe it all to you. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take, let's see, will we be here? Yeah, we'll be here next Sunday. Yep, brand new TWIT, brand new year, lots of great stories. I hope lots of insight and entertainment for you, too. Thanks for joining me, and well, we'll see you next year. Another TWIT is in the can. Amazing. Take care.